asshole, Steve didn't hold that against him. Harris, though. Harris was in a whole other league. Appleton had leaned forward at this point, making his lone contribution to the discussion before Marinville's agent could get to the final commandment. "What's your impression of Johnny?" he asked Steve. "He's 56 years old, you know, and he's put a lot of hard mileage on the original equipment, especially in the 80s. He wound up in the emergency room 3 different times, twice in Connecticut and once down here. The first 2 were drug ODs. I'm not telling tales out of school, because all that's been reported, exhaustively, in the press. The last one may have been a suicide attempt, and that is a tale out of school. I'd ask you to keep it to yourself." Steve had nodded. "So, what do you think?" Appleton asked. "Can he really drive almost half a ton of motorcycle cross-country from Connecticut to California and do 20 or so readings and receptions along the way? I want to know what you think, Mr. Ames, because I'm frankly doubtful." He had expected Harris to come busting in then, touting the legendary strength and iron balls of his client. Steve knew suits, he knew agents, and Harris was both. But Harris was silent, just looking at him. Maybe he wasn't so stupid after all, Steve thought. Maybe he even cared a little for this particular client. "You guys know him a lot better than I do," he said. "Hell, I only met him for the first time 2 weeks ago, and I've never read one of his books." Harris's face said that last didn't surprise him at all. "Precisely why I'm asking you," Appleton replied. "We have known him for a long time. Me since 1985, when he used to party with the beautiful people at 54. Bill since 1965. He's the literary world's Jerry Garcia." "That's unfair," Harris said stiffly. Appleton shrugged. "New eyes see clear," my grandmother used to say. "So tell me, Mr. Ames, do you think he can do it?" Steve had seen the question was serious, maybe even vital, and thought it over for almost a full minute. The other two men sat and let him. "Well," he had said at last, "I don't know if he can just eat the cheese and stay away from the wine at the receptions, but make it across to California on the bike? Yeah, probably. He looks fairly strong. A lot better than Jerry Garcia did near the end, I'll tell you that. I've worked with a lot of rockers half his age who don't look as good." Appleton had looked dubious. "Mostly, though, it's a look he gets on his face. He wants to do this. He wants to get out on the road, kick some ass, take down some names, and..." Steve had found himself thinking of his favorite movie, one he watched on tape every year or so, Hombre, with Paul Newman and Richard Boone. He had smiled a little. "And he looks like a man who's still got a lot of hard bark left on him." "Ah." Appleton had looked downright mystified at that. Steve hadn't been much surprised. If Appleton had ever come equipped with hard bark, Steve thought it had probably all rubbed off by the time he was a sophomore at Exeter or Choate, or wherever he'd gone to wear his blazers and rep ties. Harris had cleared his throat. "If we've got that out of the way, the final commandment..." Appleton groaned. Harris went on looking at Steve, pretending not to hear. "The fifth and final commandment," he had repeated. "Thou shalt not pick up hitchhikers in thy truck. Neither male nor female shalt thou pick them up, but especially not female." Which was probably why Steve Ames never hesitated when he saw the girl standing beside the road just outside Ely. The skinny girl with her nose bent and her hair dyed 2 different colors. He just pulled over and stopped. She opened the door, but didn't get into the cab at first, just looked up at him from across the map-littered seat with wide blue eyes. "Are you a nice person?" she asked. Steve thought this over, then nodded. "Yeah, I guess so," he said. "I like a cigar 2 or 3 times a day, but I never kicked a dog that wasn't bigger'n me, and I send money home to my mama once every 6 weeks." "You're not going to try to slap the make on me or anything?" "Nope," Steve said, amused. He liked the way her wide blue eyes remained fixed on his face. She looked like a little kid studying the funny pages. I'm fairly well under control in that regard. And you're not like a crazy serial killer or anything. No, but Jesus Christ, do you think I'd tell you if I was? I'd probably see it in your eyes, the skinny girl with the two-tone hair told him. And although she sounded grave enough, she was smiling a little. I got a psychic streak. It ain't wide, but it's there, buddy. It's really, really there. A refrigerator truck roared past, the guy laying on his horn all the way by, even though Steve had squeezed over until the stubby rider was mostly on the shoulder, and the road itself was empty in both directions. No big surprise about that, though. In Steve's experience, some guys simply couldn't keep their hands off their horns or their dicks. They were always honking one or the other. Enough with the questionnaire, lady. Do you want to ride or not? I've got to roll my wheels. In truth, he was a lot closer to the boss than the boss would maybe approve of. Marinville liked the idea of being on his own in America. Mr. Free Bird, have pen, will travel. And Steve thought that was just how he'd write his book. That was fine, too. Great. Totally cool. But he, Stephen Andrew Ames of Lubbock, also had a job to do. His was to make sure Marinville didn't have to write the book on a Ouija board instead of his word processor. His view on how to accomplish that end was simplicity itself. Stay close and let no situation get out of hand unless it absolutely couldn't be helped. He was 70 miles back instead of 150, but what the boss didn't know wouldn't hurt him. "You'll do, I guess," she said, hopped up into the cab and slammed the door shut. "Well, thank you, Cookie," he said. "I'm touched by your trust." He checked the rearview mirror, saw nothing but the ass end of Ely, and got back out on the road again. "Don't call me that," she said. "It's sexist." "Cookie is sexist? Oh, please." In a prim little no-nonsense voice, she said, "Don't call me Cookie, and I won't call you Cake." He burst out laughing. She probably wouldn't like it, but he couldn't help it. That was the way laughing was, sort of like farting. Sometimes you could hold it in, but a lot of times you couldn't. He glanced at her and saw that she was laughing a little too, and slipping her backpack off, so maybe that was all right. He put her at about 5'6" and skinny as a rail, 100 pounds max, and probably more like 95. She was wearing a tank top with torn-off sleeves. It gave an awfully generous view of her breasts for a girl worried about meeting Ted Bundy in a rider van. Not that she had a lot to worry about up there. Steve guessed she could still shop in the training bra section at Walmart if she wanted to. On the front of the shirt, a black guy with dreadlocks grinned from the middle of a blue-green psychedelic sunburst. Bent around his head like a halo were the words, "Not gonna give it up." "You must like Peter Tosh," she said. "It can't be my tits." "I worked with Peter Tosh once," he replied. "No way." "Way," he said. He glanced in the rear view and saw that Ely was already gone. It was spooky how fast that happened out here. He supposed that if he were a young female hitchhiker, he might ask a question or two himself before hopping willy-nilly into someone's car or truck. It might not help, but it sure couldn't hurt, because once you were out in the desert, anything could happen to you. "When did you work with Peter Tosh?" "1980 or 81, he said. "I can't remember which. Madison Square Garden, then in Forest Hills. Dylan played the encore with him at Forest Hills. Blowing in the Wind, if you can believe that." She was looking at him with frank amazement, unmixed, so far as he could tell, with doubt. "Whoa, cool. What were you, a roadie?" "Then, yeah. Later on I was a guitar tech. Now I'm..." Yes, that was a good start, but just what was he now? Not a guitar tech, that was for sure. Sort of demoted to roadie again. Also part-time shrink. Also sort of like Mary Poppins, only with long brown hippie hair that was starting to show some gray along the center part. "Now I'm into something else. What's your name?" "Cynthia Smith," she said, and held out a hand. He shook it. Her hand was long, feather-light inside of his, and incredibly fine-boned. It was a little like shaking hands with a bird. I'm Steve Ames, from Texas. Yeah, Lubbock. Guess you heard the accent before, huh? Once or twice. Her gammon grin lit up her whole face. You can take the boy out of Texas, but... He joined her for the rest of it, and they grinned at each other, already friends. The way people can become friends for a little while, when they happen to meet on American back roads that go through the lonely places. 3. Cynthia Smith was clearly a flake, but Steve was a veteran flake himself. You couldn't spend most of your adult life in the music business without succumbing to flakedom, and it didn't bother him. She told him she had every reason to be careful of guys. One had nearly torn off her left ear, and another had broken her nose not so long ago. And the one who did the ear was a guy I liked, she added. I'm sensitive about the ear. The nose, I think the nose has character, but I'm sensitive about the ear. God knows why. He glanced across at her ear. Well, it's a little flat on top, I guess, but so what? If you're really sensitive about it, you could grow your hair out and cover it up, you know. Not happening, she said firmly, and fluffed her hair, leaning briefly to the right, so she could get a look at herself in the mirror mounted on her side of the cab. The half on Steve's side was green, the other half was orange. My friend Gert says I look like Little Orphan Annie from Hell. That's too cool to change. Not gonna give them curls up, huh? She smiled, patted the front of her shirt, and lapsed into a passable Jamaican imitation. I go my own way, just like Peter Mon. Cynthia Smith's way had been to leave home and her parents' more or less constant disapproval at the age of 17. She had spent a little time on the East Coast. I left when I realized I was getting to be a mercy fuck, she said matter-of-factly, and then had drifted back as far as the Midwest, where she had gotten sort of clean and met a good-looking guy at an AA meeting. The good-looking guy had claimed to be entirely clean, but he had lied. Oh, boy, had he lied. Cynthia had moved in with him just the same, a mistake. I've never been what you'd call bright about men, she told Steve in that same matter-of-fact voice. The good-looking guy had come home one night, fucked up on crystal meth, and had apparently decided he wanted Cynthia's left ear as a bookmark. She had gone to a shelter, gotten a little more than sort of clean, even worked as a counselor for a while after the woman in charge had been murdered and it looked as if the place might close. The guy who murdered Anna is the same guy who broke my nose, she said. He was bad. Richie, the guy who wanted my ear for a bookmark, he only had a bad temper. Norman was bad, as in crazy. They catch him? Cynthia solemnly shook her head. Anyway, we couldn't let DNS go under just because one guy went crazy when his wife left him, so we all pitched in to save it. We did, too. DNS? Stands for Daughters and Sisters. I got a lot of my confidence back while I was there. She was looking out the window at the passing desert and rubbing the ball of her thumb pensively along the bent bridge of her nose. In a way, even the guy who did this helped me with that. Norman. Yep. Norman Daniels, that was his name, at least me and Gert, she's my pal, the one who says I look like Orphan Annie, stood up to him, you know? Uh-huh. So, last month, I finally wrote home to my folks. I put my return address on the letter, too. I thought when they wrote back, if they ever did, they'd be righteously pissed, my dad especially. He used to be a minister. He's retired now, but... You can take the boy out of the hellfire, but you can't take the hellfire out of the boy. Steve said. She smiled. Well, that's sort of what I expected, but the letter I got back was pretty neat. I called them. We talked. My dad cried. She said this with a touch of wonder. I mean, he cried. Can you believe that? Hey, I toured for 8 months with Black Sabbath, Steve said. I can believe anything. So you're going home, huh? Return of the prodigal cookie? She gave him a look. He gave her a grin. Sorry. Yeah, sure you are. Anyway, that's close. Where's home? Bakersfield, which reminds me, how far are you going? San Francisco, but... She grinned. Are you kidding? That's so cool! But I can't promise to take you that far. In fact, I can't absolutely promise to take you any further than Austin, the one in Nevada, you know, not the one in Texas. I know where Austin is. I've got a map, she said, and now she was giving him a stupid big brother look that he liked even better than her wide-eyed Miss Prim gaze. She was a cutie, all right, and wouldn't she just love it if he told her that? I'll take you as far as I can, but this gig is a little weird. I mean, all gigs are kind of weird. Show business is weird by nature, and this is showbiz. I guess, anyway, but... I mean... He stopped. What did he mean, exactly? His span of employment as a writer's roadie, an ill-fitting title. You didn't have to be a writer yourself to know that, but the only one he could think of, was almost over, and he still didn't know what to think of it, or of Johnny Merenville himself. All he knew for sure was that the great man hadn't asked Steve to score him any dope or women, and that he'd never answered Steve's knock on his hotel room door with whiskey on his breath. For now, that was enough. He could think about how he was going to describe it on his resume later. "What is the gig?" she asked. "I mean, this doesn't look big enough to be a band truck. Are you touring with a folkie this time? Gordon Lightfoot? Someone like that?" Steve grinned. My guy is sort of a folky, I guess, only he plays his mouth instead of a guitar or a harmonica. That was when the cellular phone on the dashboard gave out its strident, oddly nasal cry. Meep! Meep! Steve grabbed it off the dashboard, but didn't open it right away. He looked at the girl instead. Don't say a word, he told her as the phone meeped in his hand a third time. You might get me in trouble if you do, okay? Meep, meep. She nodded. Steve flipped the phone's mouthpiece open and then pushed send on the keypad, which was how you accepted an incoming call. The first thing he was aware of when he put the phone to his ear was how heavy the static was. He was amazed the call had gone through at all. Hello? That's you, boss? There was a deeper, smoother roar behind the static, the sound of a truck going by, Steve thought, and then Merenville's voice. Steve could hear panic even through the static, and it kicked his heart into a higher gear. He had heard people talking in that tone before. It happened at least once on every rock tour, it seemed, and he recognized it at once. At Johnny Merenville's end of the line, shit of some variety had hit the fan. Steve! Steve! I'm... Ubble! Bad! He stared out at the road, running straight arrow into the desert, and felt little seeds of sweat starting to form on his brow. He thought of the boss's tubby little agent with his thou shalt nots and his bullying voice, then swept all that away. The last person he needed cluttering up his head right now was Bill Harris. Were you in an accident? Is that it? What's up, boss? Say again. Crackle, zit, crackle. Johnny, hear me? Yes, I hear you. Shouting into the phone now, knowing it was totally useless, but doing it anyway. Aware, out of the corner of his eye, that the girl was looking at him with mounting concern. What's happened to you? No answer for so long, he was positive this time that he had lost Merenville. He was taking the phone away from his ear when the boss's voice came through again, impossibly far off, like a voice coming in from another galaxy. West. Ely. Iffy. No, not Iffy, Steve thought. Not Iffy, but 50. I'm west of Ely on Highway 50. Maybe, anyway. Maybe that's what he's saying. Accident. Got to be. He drove his scoot off the road, and he's sitting out there with a bust leg and blood maybe pouring down his face. And when I get back to New York, his guys are going to crucify me, if for no other reason than that they can't crucify him. Not sure how far. Least, probably more. RV pulled off the road. It'll farther up. The heaviest blast of static yet. Then something about cops. State cops and town cops. What's... the girl in the passenger seat began. Shh. Not now. From the phone. My bike. Into the desert. Wind. A mile or so east of the RV. And that was all. Steve yelled Johnny's name into the phone half a dozen times, but only silence came back. The connection had been broken. He used the name/menu button to bring up JM in the display window, then pushed send. A recorded voice welcomed him to the Western Roaming Network. There was a pause, and then another recording told him that his call could not be completed at this time. The voice began to list all the reasons why this might be so. Steve pushed end and flipped the phone closed. God damn it! It's bad, isn't it? Cynthia asked. Her eyes were very wide again, but there was nothing cute about them now. I can see it in your face. Maybe, he said, then shook his head, impatient with himself. Probably. That was my boss. He's up the line somewhere. 70 miles would be my best guess, but it might be as much as 100. He's riding a Harley. He... Big red and cream bike? She asked, suddenly excited. Does he have long gray hair, sort of like Jerry Garcia's? He nodded. I saw him this morning, way far east of here, she said. He filled up at this little gas station cafeteria place in Pretty Nice. You know that town, Pretty Nice? He nodded. I was eating breakfast and saw him out the window. I thought he looked familiar, like I'd seen him on Oprah, or maybe Ricky Lake. He's a writer. Steve looked at the speedometer, saw he had the panel truck up to 70, and decided he can let it out just a little more. The needle crept toward 75. Outside the windows, the desert ran backward a little faster. He's crossing the country, getting material for a book. He's done some speaking, too, but mostly he just goes places and talks to people and makes notes. Anyway, he's had an accident. At least I think that's what happened. The connection was fucked, wasn't it? Uh-huh. Do you want to pull over? Let me out? Because it's no problem, if that's what you want. He thought it over carefully. Now that the initial shock was receding, his mind seemed to be ticking away coldly and precisely, as it always had before in situations like this. No, he decided. He didn't want her out, not at all. He had a situation on his hands, one that had to be dealt with right away, but that didn't mean the future could be forgotten. Appleton might be okay, even if Johnny Merrinville had high-sided his Harley and fucked himself up big time. He had looked like the sort of man who could, blazers and repties notwithstanding, accept the idea that sometimes things went wrong. Bill Harris, however, had struck Steve as a man who believed in pin the blame on the donkey when things went wrong, and jamming that pin as far up the donkey's ass as it would go. As the potential donkey, Steve decided what he would really like was a witness, one who had never set eyes on him before today. No, I'd like you to ride along, but I have to be straight with you. I don't know what we're going to find. There could be blood. I can deal with blood, she said. 4. She made no comment about how fast he was going, but when the rental truck hit 85 and the frame began to shake, she fastened her shoulder harness. Steve squeezed the gas pedal a little harder, and when the truck got up around 90, the vibration eased. He kept both hands curled around the wheel, though. The wind was kicking up, and at these speeds, a good hard gust could swerve you onto the shoulder. Then, if your tire sank in, you were in real trouble, flipping over trouble. The boss would have been even more vulnerable to wind shear on his bike, Steve reflected. Maybe that was what had happened. By now, he had told Cynthia the basic facts of his employ. He made reservations, checked routes, vetted sound systems at the places where the boss was scheduled to speak, stayed out of the way so as not to conflict with the picture the boss was painting. Johnny Merrinville, the thinking man's lone wolf, a politically correct Sam Peckinpah hero, a writer who hadn't forgotten how to hang tough and lay cool. The panel truck, Steve told her, was empty, except for some extra gear and a long wooden ramp, which Johnny could ride up if the weather got too foul to cycle in. Since this was midsummer, that wasn't very likely, but there was another reason for the ramp as well, and for the tie-down Steve had installed on the floor of the van before setting out. This one was unspoken by either of them, but both had known it was there from the day they had set out from Westport, Connecticut. Johnny Merrinville might wake up one morning and simply find himself unwilling to keep riding the Harley, or incapable of it. "I've heard of him," Cynthia said, "but I never read anything by him. I like Dean Koontz and Danielle Steele, mostly. I just read for pleasure. Nice bike, though, and the guy had great hair. Rock and roll hair, you know?" Steve nodded. He knew. Merrinville did, too. "You really worried about him, or just worried about what might happen to you?" He likely would have resented the question if someone else had asked it, but he sensed no implied criticism in Cynthia's tone, only curiosity. "I'm worried about both," he said. She nodded. "How far have we come?" He glanced down at the odometer. 45 miles since I lost him off the phone. "But you don't know exactly where he was calling from?" "No." "You think he just fucked himself up, or someone else, too?" He looked over at her, surprised. That the boss might have fucked someone else up was exactly what he was afraid of, but he never would have said so out loud if she hadn't raised the possibility first. "Somebody else might be involved," he had replied reluctantly. "He said something about state cops and town cops. It might have been, don't call the state cops, call the town cops. I couldn't tell for sure." She pointed to his cellular, which was back on the dashboard. "No way," he said. "I'm not calling any cops until I see what kind of mess he's gotten himself into." "And I promise that won't be in my statement if you promise not to call me Cookie anymore." He smiled a little, although he didn't feel much like smiling. "Probably that's a good idea. You could always say that your phone wouldn't work anymore," she finished. "Everybody knows how finicky those things are." "You're okay, Cynthia. You're not so bad yourself." At just under 90, the miles melted away like spring snowfall. When they were 60 miles west of the point where Steve had lost contact, he began slowing the truck a couple of miles an hour for each mile traveled. No police cars had passed them in either direction, and he supposed that was good. He said so, and Cynthia shook her head doubtfully. "It's weird, is what it is. If there's been an accident where your boss or maybe somebody else got hurt, wouldn't you think a few cop cars would have gone past us by now? Or an ambulance?" "Well, if they came from the other way, west. According to my map, the next town that way is Austin, and that's much farther ahead of us than Ely is behind us. Anything official, anything with sirens is what I mean, should be heading east to west, catching up with us. Get it?"
"I guess so, yeah."
"So where are they?"
"I don't know."
"Me either."
"Well, keep looking for... well, shit, who knows? Anything out of the ordinary."
"I am. Slow down a little more." He glanced at his watch and saw it was 5:45. The shadows had drawn long across the desert, but the day was still bright and hot. If Merrinville was out there, they would see him.
"You bet we will," he thought. "He's going to be sitting at the edge of the road, probably with his head busted and half his pants torn off from where he spilled and rolled, and likely making notes on how it felt. Thank God he wears his helmet, at least. If he didn't..."
"I see something, up there." The girl's voice was excited but controlled. She was shading her eyes from the westering sun with her left hand and pointing with her right. "See? Could that..." "Oh, shit, no. That's way too big to be a motorcycle. Looks like a motorhome."
"I think this is where he called from, though. Somewhere around here, anyway."
"What makes you think so?"
"He said there was an RV off the road a little farther up. I heard that part quite clearly. He said he was about a mile east of it, and that's about where we are now, so... Yeah, don't say it. I'm looking. He slowed the Ryder truck to 30, then, as they approached the RV, to walking pace. Cynthia had unrolled the passenger window and was halfway out of it, her tank top riding up to reveal the small of her back. The small, small of her back, Steve thought, and the ridge of her spine. Anything? He asked her. At all? Nope. I saw a glint, but it was way out on the desert floor, a lot farther than he'd have gone if he'd cracked up, or if the wind pushed him off the road, you know? Probably the sun reflecting off the mica in the rocks. Uh-huh, could have been. Don't fall out that window, girl. I'm fine, she said, then winced her eyes shut as the wind, which was becoming steadily more grumpy, threw grit in her face. If this is the RV he was talking about, we're already past where he called from. She nodded. Yeah, but keep going. If there's somebody home in there, they might have saw him. He snorted. Might have saw him. Did you learn that reading Dean Koontz and Danielle Steele? She pulled in long enough to give him a haughty look, but he thought he saw hurt beneath it. Sorry, he said. I was only teasing. Oh, she said coolly. Tell me something, Mr. Big Texas Roadie. Have you read anything your boss has written? Well... He gave me a copy of Hopper's with a story of his in it. Heaven Sent Weather, it was called. I read that, sure did. Every word. Did you understand every word? No. Look, what I said was snotty. I do apologize, sincerely. Okay, she said, but her tone suggested that he was going to be on probation, at least for a while. He opened his mouth to say something that might be funny, if he was lucky, something that would get her to smile. She had a nice one. And then he got a really good look at the RV. Oh, hey, what's this? He asked, speaking more to himself than to the girl. What's what? She turned her head to look out through the windshield as Steve coasted the Ryder truck to a stop on the shoulder, just behind the RV. It was one of the middle-sized ones. Bigger than Lassie, but smaller than the Godzillas he had been seeing ever since Colorado. Guy must have run over some nails in the road or something, Steve said. Tires look like they're all flat. Yeah, so how come yours aren't? By the time it occurred to him that the people in the RV might have been public-spirited enough to pick up the nails, the girl with the punky two-tone hair was out of the cab and walking up to the RV, hallooing. Well, she knows a good exit line when she gets one off. Give her that, he thought, and got out on his side. Wind struck him in the face, hard enough to rock him back on his heels, and it was hot, like air blown over the top of an incinerator. Steve? Her voice was different. The prickly pertness, which he thought might have been the girl's way of flirting, was gone. Come over here. I don't like this. She was standing by the side door of the RV. It was unlatched, banging back and forth in the wind a little, even though this was the lee side and the steps were down. It wasn't the door or the steps she was looking at, though. At the foot of the stairs, half buried in sand that the wind had blown beneath the RV, was a doll with blonde hair and a bright blue dress. It lay face down and abandoned. Steve didn't care for the look of this much, either. Dolls with no little girls around to mind them were sort of creepy under any conditions. That was his opinion, at least. And to come upon one abandoned by the roadside, half buried in blowing sand. He opened the unlatched door and poked his head into the RV. It was brutally hot, at least 110 degrees. Hello? Anybody? But he knew better. If they'd been here, the people who owned this RV, they would have been running the engine for the air conditioning. Don't bother. Cynthia had picked up the doll and was brushing sand from its hair and the folds of its dress. This is no dime store dolly, not huge bucks, but expensive, and someone cared about her. Look. She pulled out the skirt with her fingers so he could see where a small, neat patch had been sewn over a rip. It matched the dress almost exactly in color. If the girl who owned this doll was around, it wouldn't have been out lying in the dirt. I practically guarantee you that. The question is, why didn't she take it with her when she and her folks left, or at least put it back inside? She opened the door, hesitated, went up one of the two steps, hesitated again, looked back at him. Come on. I can't. I have to find the boss. In a minute, okay? I don't want to go in here by myself. It's like the Andrea Doria or something. You mean the Mary Celeste. The Andrea Doria sank. Okay, smarty britches, whatever. Come on, it won't take long. Besides... She hesitated. Besides, it might have something to do with my boss. Is that what you're thinking? Cynthia nodded. It's not that big a reach. I mean, they're both gone, aren't they? He didn't want to accept that, though. It felt like a complication he didn't deserve. She saw some of that on his face, maybe even all of it. She sure wasn't dumb, and tossed up her hands. Oh, shit, I'll look around myself. She went inside, still holding the doll. Steve looked thoughtfully after her for a moment, then followed. Cynthia glanced back at him, nodded, then put the doll down in one of the captain's chairs. She fanned her tank top at her neck. Hot, she said. I mean boogery. She walked into the RV's cabin. Steve went the other way, into the driver's area, ducking his head so as not to bump it. On the dashboard in front of the passenger seat were three packs of baseball cards, neatly sorted into teams. Cleveland Indians, Cincinnati Reds, Pittsburgh Pirates. He thumbed through them and saw that about half were signed, and maybe half of the signed ones were personalized. Across the bottom of Albert Bell's card was this: To David, keep slugging, Albert Bell. And another from the Pittsburgh pile: See the ball before you swing, Dave. Your friend, Andy Van Slyke. There was a boy, too, Cynthia called, unless the girl was into G.I. Joe and Judge Dredd and the Motocops, as well as dollies in blue dresses. One of the side carriers back here is full of comic books. Yep, there's a boy, Steve said, putting Albert Bell and Andy Van Slyke back into their respective decks. He just brought the ones that were really important to him, he thought, smiling a little. The ones he absolutely could not bear to leave home. His name is David. Startled. How in the hell do you know that? Learned it all watching X-Files. He picked up a gas credit card receipt from the wad of papers jammed into the dashboard map receptacle and smoothed it out. The name on it was Ralph Carver. The address somewhere in Ohio. The carbon had blurred across the town name, but it might have been Wentworth. I don't suppose you know anything else about him, do you? She asked. Last name? Where he came from? David Carver, he said, the smile widening into a grin. Dad's Ralph Carver. They hail from Wentworth, Ohio. Nice town, next door to Columbus. I was in Columbus with Southside Johnny in 86. She came forward, the doll curled against one mosquito-bumped breast. Outside, the wind gusted again, throwing sand against the RV. It sounded like hard rain. You're making that up. No'm, he said, and held out the gas receipt. Here's the Carver part. David I got from the kid's baseball cards. He's got some high-priced ink, tell you that. She picked the cards up, looked at them, then put them back and turned slowly all the way around, her face solemn and shiny with sweat. He was sweating himself, and plenty. He could feel it running down his body like a light, sticky oil. Where did they go? Nearest town to get help, he said. Probably someone gave them a lift. Do you remember from your map what's around here? No. There is a town, I think, but I don't recall the name. But if that's what they did, why didn't they lock up their place when they left? I mean, all their shit is here. She waved one hand toward the cabin. Know what's back there by the studio couch?
Nope.
The wife's jewelry caddy, a ceramic frog. You put your rings and earrings in the frog's mouth.
That sounds tasteful.
He wanted to get out of here, and not just because it was so nasty hot, or because he had to track down the boss. He wanted to get out because the RV was like the fucking Mary Celeste. It was too easy to imagine vampires hidden away in the closets. Vampires in Bermuda shorts and t-shirts saying things like, "I survived Highway 50, the loneliest highway in America." "It's actually cute," she said, "but that's not the point. There's two sets of earrings and a finger ring in it. Not real expensive, but not junk either. The ring's a tourmaline, I think. So why didn't they..." She saw something in the map holder, something that had been revealed when he stirred the crammed-in papers, and plucked out a dollar-sign money clip that looked like real silver. There were bills folded into it. She fanned them quickly with the tip of a finger, then tossed the money clip back into the map holder as if it were hot.
"How much?" he asked.
40 or so," she said. "The clip itself's probably worth 3 or 4 times that much. Tell you what, Pilgrim, this smells bad." Another gust of wind splashed sand against the northern side of the RV, this one hard enough to rock it a little on its flat tires. The two of them looked at each other out of their sweat-shiny faces. Steve met the doll's blank blue gaze. "What happened here, honey? What did you see?" He turned for the door. "Time for the cops?" Cynthia asked.
"Soon. First, I want to walk a mile of back trail, see if I can spot any sign of my boss."
"In this wind? Man, that's really dumb." He looked at her for a moment, not saying anything, then pushed past her and went down the steps. She caught up with him at the foot of them. "Hey, let's call it even, okay? You made fun of my grammar, I made fun of your whatever."
"Intuition."
"Intuition. Is that what you call it? Well, fine. Call it even? Say yeah, please. I'm too spooked to want to piss in the cat box." He smiled at her, a little touched by the anxiety on her face.
"Okay, yeah," he said, "even as even can be."
"You want me to drive the truck back? I can do a mile by the odometer, give you a finishing line to shoot for."
"Can you turn it around without..."
A semi with Kleenex softens the blow written on the side blasted past at 70, headed east. Cynthia flinched back from it, shielding her eyes from flying sand with one Kate Moss arm. Steve put his own arm around her scant shoulders, steadying her for a moment or two.
"Without getting stuck," he finished.
She gave him an annoyed look and stepped out from under his arm.
"Course.
Well...
mile and a half, okay? Just to be on the safe side."
"Okay." She started toward the Ryder truck, then turned back to him. "I just remembered the name of the little town that's close to here," she said, and pointed east. "It's up that way, south of the highway. Cute name. You're gonna love it, Lubbock."
"What?"
"Desperation." She grinned and climbed up into the cab of the truck.
5.
He walked slowly east along the shoulder of the westbound lane, raising his hand in a wave but not looking up as the Ryder truck, with Cynthia behind the wheel, rumbled slowly past.
"I don't have the slightest idea what you're looking for," she called down to him.
She was gone before he had any chance to reply, which was just as well. He didn't have any idea either.
"Tracks?" A ridiculous idea, given the wind.
"Blood? Bits of chrome or taillight glass?" He supposed that was actually the most likely. He only knew two things for sure. That his instincts had not just asked him to do this, but demanded it. And that he couldn't get the doll's glazy blue stare out of his mind. Some little girl's favorite doll. Only... the little girl had left Alice Bluegown lying face down in the dirt by the side of the road. Mom had left her jewelry, Dad had left his money clip, and son David had left his autographed baseball cards. Why? Up ahead, Cynthia swung wide, then turned the bright yellow truck so it was facing back west again. She did this with an economy Steve wasn't sure he could have matched himself, needing to back and fill just a single time. She got out, started walking toward him at a good clip, hardly looking down at all, and he had time, even then, to be moderately pissed that she should have found what his instinct had sent him out here to look for. "Hey," she said. She bent over, picked something up, and shook sand off it. He jogged to where she was standing. "What? What is it?" "Little notebook," she said, and held it out. "I guess he was here, all right. J. Marinville, printed right on the front. See?" He took the small wire-bound notepad with the bent cover and paged through it quickly. Directions, maps Steve had drawn himself, and jotted notes in the boss's top-heavy scrawl, most of them about the scheduled receptions. Under the heading St. Louis, Marinville had scribbled, "Patricia Franklin, redhead, big boobs. Don't call her Pat or Patty. Name of org is Friends of Open Lives. Bill says PF also active in animal rights stuff. Veggie." On the last page which had been used, a single word had been scrawled in an even more flamboyant version of the boss's handwriting. "For..." That was all, as if he had started to write an autograph for someone and then never finished. He looked up at Cynthia and saw her cross her arms beneath her scant bosom and begin rubbing the points of her elbows. "Bruh," she said. "It's impossible to be cold out here, but I am just the same. This keeps getting spookier and spookier." "How come this didn't just fly away in the breeze?" "Pure luck. It blew against a big rock and then sand covered the bottom half. Like with the doll. If he dropped it 6 inches to the right or left, it'd probably be halfway to Mexico by now." "What makes you think he dropped it?" "Don't you?" she asked. He opened his mouth to say he really didn't think anything, at least not yet, and then forgot all about it. He was seeing a glint out in the desert, probably the same one Cynthia had seen while they were coming up on the RV, only they weren't moving now, so the glint was staying steady. And it wasn't just mica chips embedded in rock. He would bet on that. For the first time, he was really painfully afraid. He was running out into the desert, running toward the glint, before he was even aware he meant to do it. "Hey, don't go so fast!" She sounded startled. "Wait up!" "No, stay there," he called back. He sprinted the first 100 yards, keeping that star point of sun directly in front of him. Except now the star point had begun to spread, to take on a shape he found dreadfully familiar. And then a wave of dizziness hit and stopped him. He bent over with his hands grasping his legs just above the knees, convinced that every cigar he had smoked in the last 18 years had come back to haunt him. When the vertigo passed a little and the padded jackhammer sound of his heartbeat began to diminish in his ears, he heard a distinct but somehow ladylike puffing from behind him. He turned and saw Cynthia approaching at a jog, sweating hard but otherwise fine and dandy. Her gaudy curls had flattened a little, that was all. "You stick like a booger on the end of a finger," he panted as she pulled up beside him. "I think that's the sweetest thing a guy ever said to me. Put it in your fucking haiku book, why don't you? And don't have a heart attack. How old are you, anyway?" He straightened up with an effort. "Too old to be interested in your giblets, Chicken Little. And I'm fine. Thanks for your concern." On the highway, a car blipped by without slowing. They both looked. Out here, each passing car was a noticed event. "Well, can I suggest we walk the rest of the way? Whatever that thing is, it's not going anywhere." "I know what it is," he said, and trotted the last 20 yards. He knelt before it like a primitive tribesman before an effigy. The boss's Harley had been hurriedly and indifferently buried. The wind had already freed one handlebar and part of another. The girl's shadow fell over him, and he looked up at her, wanting to say something that would make her believe he wasn't completely freaked out by this, but nothing came. He wasn't sure she would have heard him anyway. Her eyes were wide and scared, riveted on the bike. She fell to her knees beside him, held out her hands as if measuring, then dug a little distance to the right of the handlebars. The first thing she found was the boss's helmet. She pulled it free, poured the sand out of it, and set it aside. Then she brushed delicately beneath where it had been. Steve watched her. He wasn't sure his legs would support him if he wanted to get up. He kept thinking of the stories you saw in the paper from time to time. Stories about bodies being discovered in gravel pits and pulled out of the ever-popular shallow grave. Along the scooped declivity she had made, he now saw painted metal bright against the gray-brown sand. The colors were red and cream, and letters, Harl. "That's it," she said. Her words were indistinct because she was rubbing one hand compulsively back and forth across her mouth. "That's the one I saw, all right." Steve grabbed the handlebars and tugged. Nothing. He wasn't surprised. It was a pretty feeble tug. He suddenly realized something that was interesting in a horrible sort of way. It wasn't just the boss he was worried about anymore. No, sir. His concerns had widened, it seemed. And he had this feeling, this weird feeling, as if... "Steve, my nice new friend," Cynthia said in a little voice, looking up at him from the little bit of fuel nacelle she had uncovered. "You're probably going to think this is primo stupid, the sort of thing dumb broads are always saying in lousy movies, but I feel like we're being watched." "I don't think you're being stupid," he said, and scooped a little more sand away from the nacelle. No blood. Thank God for that. Which wasn't to say that there wasn't blood on the damn thing somewhere, or a body buried beneath it. "I feel that way, too. Can we get out of here?" she asked, almost pleaded. She wiped sweat off her brow with one arm. "Please?" He stood up and they started back. When she stuck her hand out, he was glad to take it. "God, the feeling's strong," she said. "Is it strong for you?"
"Yeah. I don't think it means anything except being really scared, but yeah, it's strong. Like..."
A howl rose in the distance, wavering. Cynthia's grip on his hand tightened enough for Steve to be grateful that she bit her nails. "What's that?" she whimpered. "Oh, my God, what is it?"
"Coyote," he said, "just like in the Western movies. They won't hurt us. Let up a little, Cynthia, you're killing me."
She started to, then clamped down again when a second howl came, wrapping itself lazily around the first, like a good barbershop tenor doing harmony.
"They're nowhere close," he said, now having to work in order to keep himself from pulling his hand out of hers. She was a lot stronger than she looked, and she was hurting. "Really, kiddo, they're probably in the next county. Relax."
She eased up on his hand, but when she turned her shiny face to him, it was almost pitifully frightened. "Okay, they're nowhere close. They're probably in the next county. They're probably phoning it in from across the California state line, in fact. But I don't like things that bite. I'm scared of things that bite. Can we go back to your truck?"
"Yes."
She walked with her hip brushing his, but when the next howl came, she didn't squeeze his hand quite so hard. That one clearly was at some distance, and it wasn't immediately repeated. They reached the truck. Cynthia got in on the passenger side, giving him one quick, nervous smile over her shoulder as she hauled herself up. Steve walked around the truck's hood, realizing as he went that the sensation of being watched had slipped away. He was still scared, but now it was primarily for the boss again. If John Edward Merrinville was dead, the headlines would be worldwide, and Stephen Ames would undoubtedly be part of the story. Not a good part. Stephen Ames would be the fail-safe that failed, the safety net that hadn't been there when Big Daddy finally fell off the trapeze. That feeling of being watched. Probably it was the coyotes, she said. You think?
Maybe.
What now? Cynthia asked. He took a deep breath and reached for the cellular phone.
Time for the cops, he said, and dialed 911.
What he heard in his ear was what he had pretty much expected, one of those cellnet recorded voices telling him it was sorry, but his call could not be completed at this time. The boss had gotten through, briefly anyway, but that had been a fluke. Steve snapped the mouthpiece closed with a savage flick of his wrist, threw the phone back onto the dash, and started the rider's engine. He was dismayed to see that the desert floor had taken on a distinctly purplish cast. Shit. They'd spent more time in the deserted RV and kneeling in front of the boss's half-buried scoot than he had thought.
No, huh?
She was looking at him sympathetically.
No. Let's find this town you mentioned. What was it?
Desperation. It's east of here. He dropped the gearshift lever into drive.
Navigate for me, will you?
Sure, she said, and then touched his arm. We'll get help. Even in a town that small, there's got to be at least one cop. He drove up to the abandoned RV before turning east again and saw the door was still flapping. Neither of them had thought to latch it. He stopped the truck, ran the transmission up into park, and opened his own door. Cynthia grabbed his shoulder before he could swing more than one leg out.
Hey, where you going?
Not panic, but not exactly serene either.
Easy, girl, just give me a sec.
He got out and latched the door of the RV, which was something called a Wayfarer, according to the chrome on its flank. Then he came back to the idling rider truck.
What are you, one of those type A guys? She asked.
Not usually. I just didn't like that thing banging in the breeze.
He paused, one foot on the running board, looking up at her, thinking. Then he shrugged.
It was like looking at a shutter on a haunted house.
Okay, she said, and then more howls rose in the distance, maybe south of them, maybe east. With the wind, it was hard to tell, but this time it sounded like at least half a dozen voices. This time, it sounded like a pack. Steve got up in the cab and slammed the door.
Come on, he said, pulling the transmission lever down into drive again. Let's turn this rig around and find us some law.
Chapter 5. 1. David Carver saw it while the woman in the blue shirt and faded jeans was finally giving up, huddling back against the bars of the drunk tank and holding her forearms protectively against her breasts as the cop pulled the desk away so he could get at her. "Don't touch it," the white-haired man had said when the woman threw the shotgun down and it came clattering across the hardwood floor to bang off the bars of David's cell.
Don't touch it. It's empty. Just leave it alone.
He had done what the man said, but he had seen something else on the floor when he looked down at the shotgun, one of the shells that had fallen off the desk. It was lying on its side against the far left-hand vertical bar of his cell. Fat green shotgun shell, maybe one of a dozen that had gone rolling every which way when the crazy cop had started battering the woman, Mary, with the desk and the chair in order to make her drop the gun. The old guy was right. It would make no sense to go grabbing for the shotgun. Even if he could also get the shell, it would make no sense to do that. The cop was big, tall as a pro basketball player, broad as a pro football player. And the cop was also fast. He'd be on David, who had never held a real gun in his life, before David could even figure out what hole the shell went in. But if he should get a chance to pick up the shell, maybe. Well, who knew? "Can you walk?" the cop was asking the woman named Mary. His tone was grotesquely solicitous. "Is anything broken?" "What difference does it make?" Her voice was trembling, but David thought it was rage making that tremble, not fear. "Kill me if you're going to. Get it over with." David glanced at the old guy who was in the cell with him, wanting to see if the old guy had also noticed the shell. So far as David could tell, he hadn't, although he had finally gotten off the bunk and come to the cell bars. Instead of yelling at the woman who had tried her very best to blow his head off, or maybe hurting her for it, the cop gave her a brief one-armed hug, a pal's hug. In a way, David found this seemingly sincere little gesture of affection more unsettling than all the violence which had gone before it. "I'm not going to kill you, Mayor." The cop looked around, as if to ask the remaining three carvers and the white-haired guy if they could believe this crazy lady. His bright gray eyes met David's blue ones, and the boy took an unplanned step back from the bars. He felt suddenly weak with horror, and vulnerable. How he could feel more vulnerable than he already was, he didn't know, but he did. The cop's eyes were empty, so empty that it was almost as if he were unconscious with them open. This made David think of his friend Brian and his one memorable visit to Brian's hospital room last November. But it wasn't the same, because at the same time the cop's eyes were empty, they weren't. There was something there, yes, something, and David didn't know what it was, or how it could be both something and nothing. He only knew he had never seen anything like it. The cop looked back at the woman called Mary with an expression of exaggerated astonishment. "Gosh, no," he said. "Not when things are just getting interesting." He reached into his right front pocket, brought out a ring of keys, and selected one that hardly looked like a key at all. It was square, with a black strip embedded in the center of the metal. To David, it looked a little like a hotel key card. He poked this into the lock of the big cell and opened it. "Hop in, Mayor," he said. "Snug as a bug in a rug. That's what you'll be." She ignored him, looking instead at David's parents. They were standing together at the bars of the little cell directly across from the one David was sharing with white-haired Mr. Silent. "This man, this maniac, killed my husband. Put..." She swallowed, grimacing, and the big cop looked at her benignly, seeming almost to smile encouragement. "Get this out, Mary. Sick it up. You'll feel better when you do." "Put his arm around him like he did me just now and shot him 4 times. "He killed our little girl," Ellen Carver told her, and something in her tone struck David with a moment of utter dreamlike unreality. It was as if the two of them were playing Can You Top This? Next, the woman named Mary would say, "Well, he killed our dog," and then his mother would say, "We don't know that," David's father said. He looked horrible, face swollen and bloody, like a heavyweight boxer who has taken 12 full rounds of punishment. "Not for sure." He looked at the cop, a terrible expression of hope on his swollen face, but the cop ignored him. It was Mary he was interested in. "That's enough chit-chat," he said. He sounded like the world's kindliest grandpa. "Hop into your room, Mary mine. Into your gilded cage, my little blue-eyed parakeet." "Or what? You'll kill me?" "I already told you I won't," he said in that same kind old Gramps voice. "But you don't want to forget the world-renowned fate worse than death." His voice hadn't changed, but she was now looking up at him raptly, like a staked goat at an approaching boa constrictor. "I can hurt you, Mary," he said. "I can hurt you so badly, you'll wish I had killed you. Now, you believe that, don't you?" She looked at him a moment longer, then tore her eyes away. And that was just what it felt like to David from his place 20 feet away, her pulling free, the way you'd pull a piece of tape off the flap of a letter or a package, and walked into the cell. Her face shivered as she went, then broke apart as the cop slammed the cell's barred door behind her. She threw herself onto one of the four bunks at the rear, put her face into her arms, and began to sob. The cop stood watching her for a moment, head lowered. David had time to look down at the shotgun shell again and think about grabbing it. Then the big cop jerked and kind of shook himself like someone waking from a doze and turned away from the cell with the sobbing woman in it. He walked across to where David was standing. The white-haired man retreated rapidly from the bars as the cop came, until the backs of his knees struck the edge of the bunk and he folded down to a sitting position. Then he put his hands over his eyes again. Before, that had seemed like a gesture of despair to David, but now it seemed to echo the horror he himself had felt when the cop's stare had fallen upon him. Not despair, but the instinctive hiding gesture of someone who will not look at a thing unless absolutely forced to look. "How's it going, Tom?" the cop asked the man on the bunk. "How they hanging, old-timer?" Mr. Whitehair shrank away from the sound of the voice without taking his hands away from his eyes. The cop looked at him a moment longer, then turned his gray gaze on David again. David found he couldn't look away. Now it was his eyes that had been taped. And there was something else, wasn't there? A sense of being called. "Having fun, David?" the big blonde cop asked. His eyes seemed to be expanding, turning into bright gray ponds filled with light. "Are you filling this interlude, measure for measure?" It came out a dusty croak. He licked his lips and tried again. "I don't know what you're talking about." "Don't you? I wonder about that, because I see..." He raised one hand to the corner of his mouth, touched it, then dropped it again. The expression on his face seemed to be one of genuine puzzlement. "I don't know what I see. It's a question. Yes, sir, it is. Who are you, boy?" David glanced quickly at his mother and father and could not look for long at what he saw on their faces. They thought the cop was going to kill him as he had killed Pye and Mary's husband. He turned his eyes back to the cop. "I'm David Carver," he said. "I live at 248 Poplar Street in Wentworth, Ohio." "Yes, I'm sure that's true, but little Dave, who made thee? Canst thou say who made thee? Tack!" He's not reading my mind, David thought, but I think maybe he could, if he wanted to. An adult would likely have admonished himself for such a thought, told himself not to be silly, not to succumb to fear-driven paranoia. That's just what he wants you to believe, that he's a mind reader, the adult would think. But David wasn't a man. He was a boy of 11. Not just any boy of 11 either. Not since last November. There had been some big changes since then. He could only hope they would help him deal with what he was seeing and experiencing now. The cop, meanwhile, was looking at him with narrowed, considering eyes. "I guess my mother and father made me," David said. "Isn't that the way it works?" "A boy who understands the birds and bees. Wonderful. And what about my other question, trooper? Are you having any fun?" "You killed my sister, so don't ask stupid questions." "Son, don't provoke him," his father called in a high, scared voice. It didn't really sound like his father at all. "Oh, I'm not stupid," the cop said, bending that horrid gray gaze even more closely on David. The irises actually seemed to be in motion, turning and turning like pinwheels, Looking at them made David feel nauseated, close to vomiting, but he couldn't look away. "I may be a lot of things, but stupid isn't one of them. I know a lot, Trooper. I do. I know a lot."
"Leave him alone!" David's mother screamed.
David couldn't see her. The cop's bulk blocked her out entirely.
"Haven't you done enough to our family? If you touch him, I'll kill you."
The cop paid no notice. He raised his index fingers to his lower lids and pulled them down, making the eyeballs themselves bulge out grotesquely. "I've got eagle eyes, David, and those are eyes that see the truth from afar. You just want to believe that. Eagle eyes, yes, sir." The cop continued to stare through the bars, and now it was almost as if 11-year-old David Carver had hypnotized him.
"You're quite a one, aren't you?" the cop breathed. "You're quite a one indeed. Yes, I think so."
"Think whatever you want. Just don't think about me thinking about the shotgun shell." The cop's eyes widened slightly, and for a hideous moment David thought that was exactly what the cop was thinking about, that he had tuned into David's mind as if it were a radio signal. Then a coyote howled outside, a long, lonely sound, and the cop glanced in that direction. The thread between them, maybe telepathy, maybe just a combination of fear and fascination, snapped. The cop bent to pick up the shotgun. David held his breath, fully expecting him to see the shell lying on the floor off to his right. But the cop did not glance in that direction. He stood up, flipping a lever on the side of the shotgun as he did so. It broke open, the barrels lying over his arm like an obedient animal. "Don't go away, David," he said in a confidential, just-us-guys voice. "We've got a lot to talk about. That's a conversation I'm looking forward to, believe me. But just now, I'm a little busy." He walked back toward the center of the room, head down, picking up shells as he went. The first two he loaded into the gun, the rest he stuffed absently into his pockets. David dared wait no longer. He bent, snaked his hand between the two bars on the left side of the cell, and grabbed the fat green tube. He slipped it into the pocket of his jeans. The woman named Mary didn't see. She was still lying on the bunk with her face buried in her arms, sobbing. His parents didn't see. They were standing at the bars of their cell, arms around each other's waist, watching the man in the khaki uniform with horrified fascination. David turned around and saw that old Mr. Whitehair, Tom, still had his hands to his face, so maybe that was okay, too. Except old Tom's watery eyes were open behind his fingers. David could see them, so maybe it wasn't okay. Either way, it was too late now to take it back. Still facing the man the cop had called Tom, David raised the side of one hand to his mouth in a brief, shushing gesture. Old Tom gave no sign that he saw. His eyes, in their own prison, only continued to stare out from between the bars of his fingers. The cop who had killed Pi picked up the last shell on the floor, took a brief look under the desk, then straightened and snapped the shotgun closed with a single flick of his wrist. David had watched him closely through the picking-up process, trying to get a sense of whether or not the cop was counting the shells. He hadn't thought so until now. Now the cop was just standing there, back to, head down. Then he turned and strode back to David's cell, and the boy felt his stomach turn to lead. For a moment, the cop just stood there looking at him, seeming to pry at him, and David thought, "He's trying to pick my brains the way a burglar tries to pick a lock." "Are you thinking about God?" the cop asked. "Don't bother. Out here, God's country stops at Indian Springs, and even Lord Satan don't step his cloven feet much north of Tonopah. There's no God in desperation, baby boy. Out here, there's only the candle latch. That seemed to be it. The cop walked out of the room with the shotgun now riding under his arm. There were perhaps 5 seconds of silence in the holding area, broken only by the muffled sobs of the woman named Mary. David looked at his parents, and they looked back at him. Standing that way with their arms around each other, he could see how they must have looked as small children long before they had met each other at Ohio Wesleyan, and this frightened him out of all measure. He would rather have come upon them naked and fucking. He wanted to break the silence. Couldn't think how. Then the cop suddenly sprang back into the room. He had to duck his head to keep from bumping it on the top of the doorway. He was grinning in a mad way that made David think of Garfield, the comic strip cat, when Garfield did his impromptu back fence vaudeville routines. Which this was, it seemed. There was an old telephone hung on the wall, its beige plastic casing cracked and filthy. The cop snatched it off its hook, held it to his ear, and cried, "Room service! Send me up a room!" He slammed the phone back down and turned his mad Garfield grin on his prisoners. "Old Jerry Lewis bit," he said. "American critics don't understand Jerry Lewis, but he's huge in France. I mean, he's a stud." He looked at David. "No God in France either, trooper. Take it from moi. Just Cinzano and escargot and women who don't shave their armpits." He flashed the others with his regard, the grin fading as he did so. "You people have to stay put," he said. "I know that you're scared of me, and maybe you're right to be scared, but you're locked up for a reason. Believe it. This is the only safe place for miles around. There are forces out there you don't even want to think about. And when tonight comes..." He only looked at them and shook his head somberly, as if the rest were too awful to be spoken aloud. "You lie, you liar," David thought. But then another howl drifted through the open window in the stairwell, and he wondered. "In any case," the cop said, "these are good locks and good cells. They were built by hardasses for roughneck miners, and escape's not an option. If that's been in your mind, send it home to its mama. You mind me now. That's the best thing to do. Believe me, it is." Then he was gone, this time for real. David could hear his booted feet thudding down the stairs, shaking the whole building. The boy stood where he was for a moment, knowing what he had to do now, absolutely had to do, but reluctant to do it in front of his parents. Still, there was no choice, was there? And he had been right about the cop. The big man hadn't exactly been reading his mind like it was a newspaper, but he'd been getting some of it. He'd been getting the God stuff. But maybe that was good. Better the cop should see God than the shotgun shell, maybe. He turned and took 2 slow steps to the foot of the bunk. He could feel the weight of the shell in his pocket as he went. That weight was very clear, very distinct. It was as if he had a lump of gold hidden in there. No, more dangerous than gold. A chunk of something radioactive, maybe. He stood where he was for a moment, back to the room, and then, very slowly, sank down on his knees. He took a deep breath, pulling in air until his lungs would absolutely hold no more, then let it out again in a long, silent whoosh. He folded his hands on the rough woolen blanket, dropped his forehead softly onto them. "David, what's wrong with you?" his mother called. "David!" "There isn't anything wrong with him," his father said, and David smiled a little as he closed his eyes. "What do you mean, nothing wrong?" Ellie screamed. "Look at him! He fell down! He's fainting! David!" Their voices were distant now, fading, but before they went out entirely, he heard his dad say, "Not fainting. Praying. No God in desperation? Well, let's just see about that." Then he was gone, no longer concerned about what his parents might be thinking, no longer worried that old Mr. Whitehair might have seen him filch the shotgun shell and might tell the monster cop what he had seen, no longer grieving for sweet little Pie, who had never hurt anyone in her life and hadn't deserved to die as she had. He was not, in fact, precisely even inside his own head anymore. He was in the black now, blind but not deaf, in the black and listening for his God. 2. Like most spiritual conversions, David Carver's was dramatic only on the outside. On the inside, it was quiet, almost mundane. Not rational, perhaps. Matters of the spirit may never be strictly rational, but possessed of its own clarity and logic. And to David, at least, its genuineness was beyond question. He had found God, that was all, and, this he considered probably more important, God had found him. In November of the previous year, David's best friend had been struck by a car while riding his bike to school. Brian Ross was thrown 20 feet into the side of a house. On any other morning, David would have been with him, but on that particular day, he had stayed home sick, nursing a not-too-serious virus. The phone had rung at 8:30, and his mother had come into the living room 10 minutes later, pale and trembling. "David, something's happened to Brian. Please try not to be too upset." After that, he didn't remember much of the conversation, only the words, "not expected to live." It had been his idea to go and see Brian in the hospital the next day, after calling the hospital all on his own that evening and ascertaining that his friend was still alive. "Honey, I understand how you feel, but that's a really bad idea," his father had said. His use of honey, a term of endearment long since retired along with David's stuffed toys, indicated how upset Ralph Carver was. He had looked at Ellen, but she only stood by the sink, wringing a dishcloth nervously back and forth in her hands. Obviously no help there. Not that Ralph had felt very helpful himself, God knew, but who had ever expected such a conversation? My God, the boy was only 11. Ralph hadn't even gotten around to telling him the facts of life, let alone those of death. Thank God Kirsty was in the other room, watching cartoons on TV. "No," David had said, "it's a good idea. In fact, it's the only idea." He thought of adding something heroically modest, like, "besides, Brian'd do it for me," and decided not to. He didn't think Brian would do it for him, actually. That didn't change anything, though, because he had vaguely understood, even then, before what had happened in Bear Street Woods, that he'd be going not for Brian, but for himself. His mother had advanced a few hesitant steps from her bastion by the sink. "David, you've got the dearest heart in the world, the kindest heart in the world, but Brian... he was, well, thrown." "What she's trying to say is that he hit a brick wall head first," his father said. He had reached across the table and taken one of his son's hands. "There was extensive brain damage. He's in a coma, and there are no good vital signals. Do you know what that means?" "That they think his brain turned into a cabbage." Ralph had winced, then nodded. "He's in a situation where the best thing that could happen would be for it to end fast. If you went to see him, you wouldn't be seeing the friend you know, the one you used to have sleepovers with." His mother had gone into the living room at that point, had swept the bewildered Pie into her lap, and begun to cry again. David's father glanced after her as if he'd like to join her, then turned back to David again. "It's best if you remember Bri the way he was when you saw him the last time. Understand?" "Yes, but I can't do that. I have to go see him. If you don't want to take me, that's okay, though. I'll take the bus after school." Ralph had sighed heavily. "Shit, kid, I'll take you. You won't have to wait until after school, either. Just don't, for God's sake, say anything about this to... He lifted his chin toward the living room. To Pi? Gosh, no. He didn't add that Pi had already been into his room to ask him what had happened to Brian, and had it hurt, and what did David think it was like to die, did you go somewhere, and about 100 other questions. Her face had been so solemn, so attentive. She had been, well, she had been absolutely pie-eyed. But it was often best if you didn't tell your parents everything. They were old and stuff got on their nerves. Brian's parents won't let you in, Ellie had said, coming back into the room. I've known Mark and Debbie for years. They're grief-stricken. Sure they are. If it had been you, I'd be insane. But they'll know better than to let a little boy look at another little boy who's dying. I called them after I called the hospital and asked if I could come see him, David said quietly. Mrs. Ross said okay. His dad was still holding his hand. That was okay. He loved his mom and dad very much and had been sorry this was distressing for them, but there was no question in his mind about what he was supposed to do. It had been as if some other power, one from outside, were guiding him even then, the way an older, smarter person might guide a little kid's hand to help him make a picture of a dog or a chicken or a snowman. What's the matter with her? Ellen Carver asked in a distraught voice. Just what in the hell is the matter with her? That's what I'd like to know. She said she was glad I could come say goodbye. She said they're going to turn off the life support stuff this weekend after his grandparents come to say goodbye, and she was glad I could come first. The following day, Ralph took the afternoon off from work and picked his son up at school. David had been standing at the curb with his blue, excused early pass sticking out of his shirt pocket. When they got to the hospital, they rode up to the fifth floor, ICU, in the world's slowest elevator. On the way, David tried to prepare himself for what he was going to see. "Don't be shocked, David," Mrs. Ross had said on the phone. "He doesn't look very nice. We're sure he doesn't feel any pain. He's down much too deep for that. But he doesn't look very nice." "Want me to come with you?" his father had asked outside the door of the room Brian was in. David had shaken his head. He was still powerfully in the grip of the feeling which had more or less swallowed him since his pallid mother had given him the news about the accident. That feeling of being guided by someone more experienced than he was. Someone who would be brave for him if his own courage faltered. He had gone into the room. Mr. and Mrs. Ross were there, sitting in red vinyl chairs. They had books in their hands that they weren't reading. Brian was in the bed by the window, surrounded by equipment that beeped and sent green lines rolling across video screens. A light blanket was pulled up to his waist. Above it, a thin white hospital shirt lay open like cheesy school play angel's wings on either side of his chest. There were all sorts of rubber suckers on him down there, and more attached to his head, below a vast white cap of bandage. From beneath this cap, one long cut descended Brian's left cheek to the corner of his mouth, where it curved up like a fishhook. The cut had been sutured with black thread. To David, it had looked like something out of a Frankenstein movie, one of the old ones with Boris Karloff they showed on Saturday nights. Sometimes, when he slept over at Brian's, the two of them stayed up and ate popcorn and watched those movies. They loved the old black-and-white monsters. Once, during The Mummy, Brian had turned to David and said, "Oh, shit, the mummy's after us. Let's all walk a little faster." Stupid, but at 1:15 in the morning, anything can strike 11-year-olds funny, and the two of them had laughed like fiends. Brian's eyes had looked up at him from the hospital bed, and through him. They were open and as empty as school classrooms in August. Feeling more than ever as if he were not moving, but being moved, David had walked into the magic circle of the machines. He observed the suction cups on Brian's chest and temples. He observed the wires coming out of the suction cups. He observed the oddly misshapen look of the helmet-sized bandage on the left side of Brian's head, as if the shape beneath it had been radically changed. David supposed it had been. When you hit the side of a brick house, something had to give. There was a tube in Brian's right arm and another coming out of his chest. The tubes went to bags of liquid hanging off poles. There was a plastic doodad in Brian's nose and a band on his wrist. David thought, those are the machines that are keeping him alive. And when they turn them off, when they pull out the needles... Disbelief filled him at the idea. Buds of wonder, which were only grief, rolled tight. He and Brian squirted each other at the water fountain outside their home room at school whenever they thought they could get away with it. They rode their bikes in the fabled Bear Street woods, pretending they were commandos. They swapped books and comics and baseball cards, and sometimes just sat on David's back porch, playing with Brian's Game Boy, or reading and drinking David's mom's lemonade. They slapped each other high fives and called each other bad boy. Sometimes, when it was just the two of them, they called each other fuckhead or dickweed. In the second grade, they'd pricked their fingers with pins and smooshed them together and sworn themselves blood brothers. In August of this year, they had made, with Mark Ross's help, a bottle cap Parthenon from a picture in a book. It turned out so well that Mark kept it in the downstairs hall and showed it to company. At the first of the year, the bottle cap Parthenon was slated to travel the block and a half to the Carver house. It was the Parthenon that David's mind had fixed upon most firmly as he stood by his comatose friend's bed. They had built it, him, Brian, Brian's dad, out in the Ross garage while the tape player endlessly recycled Rattle and Hum on the shelf behind them. A silly thing because it was just bottle caps. A cool thing because it looked like what it was supposed to look like. You could tell what it was. Also a cool thing because they had made it with their own hands. And soon Brian's hands would be picked up and scrubbed by an undertaker who would use a special brush and pay particular attention to the fingernails. No one would want to look at a corpse with dirty nails, David supposed. And after Bry's hands were clean and he was in the coffin his folks would pick out for him, the undertaker would lace his fingers together like they were a pair of sneakers. And that was how they'd stay, down in the ground, neatly folded, the way they had been supposed to fold their hands on their desks back in the second grade. No more bottle cap buildings for those hands. No more water fountain nozzles for those fingers. Down into the dark with them. It was not terror this thought had called up in his mind and heart, but despair. As if the image of Brian's fingers laced together in his coffin proved that nothing was worth anything, that doing never once in the world stopped dying, that not even kids were exempted from the horror show that roared on and on behind the peppermint sitcom facade your parents believed in and wanted you to believe in. Neither Mr. nor Mrs. Ross spoke to him as he stood by the bed, meditating on these things in the shorthand of children. And their silence was all right with David. He liked them just fine, especially Mr. Ross, who had a sort of interesting crazy streak. But he hadn't come here to see them. They weren't the ones with the food tubes and breathing machinery that was going to be taken away after the grandparents got a chance to say goodbye. He had come to see Brian. David had taken his friend's hand. It was astoundingly cool and lax in his own, but still alive. You could feel the life in it, running like a motor. He squeezed it gently and whispered, "How you doing, bad boy?" No response but the sound of the machine that was doing Brian's breathing for him now that his brain had blown most of its fuses. This machine was at the head of the bed, and it was the biggest. It had a clear plastic tube mounted on one side of it. Inside the tube was something that looked like a white accordion. The sound this machine made was quiet. All the machines were quiet. But the accordion thing was unsettling just the same. It made a low, emphatic noise each time it went up. A gasping noise. It was as if part of Brian wasn't down too deep to feel pain, but that part had been taken out of his body and penned up in the plastic tube, where it was now being hurt even worse, where it was being pressed to death by the white accordion thing. And then there were the eyes. David felt his eyes drawn back to them again and again. Nobody had told him Brian's eyes would be open. Until just now, he hadn't known your eyes could be open when you were unconscious. Debbie Ross had told him not to be shocked, that Brian didn't look very nice, but she hadn't told him anything about that stuffed moose stare. Maybe that was all right, though. Maybe you could never be prepared about the really awful things, not at any age. One of Brian's eyes was bloodshot, with a huge black pupil that ate up all but the thinnest ring of brown. The other was clear, and the pupil appeared to be normal, but nothing else was normal, because there was no sign of his friend in those eyes, none. The boy who had cracked him up by saying, "Oh shit, the mummy's after us, let's all walk a little faster," wasn't here at all, unless he was in the plastic tube, at the mercy of the white accordion. David would look away at the stitched fishhook cut, at the bandage, at the one waxy ear he could see below the bandage. And then his gaze would wander back to Brian's open, staring eyes with their mismatched pupils. It was the nothing that drew him, the absence, the goneness in those eyes. It was more than wrong. It was evil, a voice deep in his head whispered. It was like no voice he had ever heard in his thoughts before, a total stranger, and when Debbie Ross's hand dropped on his shoulder, he'd had to clamp his lips together against a scream. "The man who did it was drunk," she said in a husky, tear-clotted voice. Fresh tears were rolling down her cheeks. "He says he doesn't remember any of it. That he was in a blackout. And do you know the horrible thing, Davy? I believe him." "Deb," Mr. Ross began, but Brian's mom took no notice of him. "How could God let that man not remember hitting my son with his car?" Her voice had begun to rise. Ralph Carver had poked his head around the edge of the open door, startled, and a nurse rolling a cart up the hall stopped dead in her tracks. She looked into room 508 with a pair of big blue, oh goodness, eyes. "How could God be so merciful to someone who deserves to wake up screaming with memories of the blood coming out of my son's poor hurt head every night for the rest of his life?" Mr. Ross put his arm around her shoulders. Outside the door, Ralph Carver pulled his head back like a turtle withdrawing into its shell. David saw this and might have hated his dad a little for it. He couldn't remember for sure one way or the other. What he remembered was looking down at Brian's pale, still face with the misshapen bandage seeming to bear down on it, the waxy ear, the cut with its red lips drawn together in a smooch by the black thread, and the eyes. Most of all, what he remembered was the eyes. Brian's mother was right there, crying and screaming, and those eyes didn't change a bit. "But he is in there," David thought suddenly. And that thought, like so much that had happened to him since his mother had told him about Brian's accident, did not feel like something that was coming from him, but only something going through him, as if his mind and body had turned into some sort of pipe. "He is in there. I know he is. Still in there, like someone caught in a landslide or a cave-in." Debbie Ross's control had given way entirely. She was almost howling, shaking in her husband's grip, trying to pull free. Mr. Ross got her headed back toward the red chairs, but it looked like a job. The nurse hurried in and slipped an arm around her waist. "Mrs. Ross, sit down. You'll feel better if you do." "What sort of God lets a man forget killing a little boy?" Brian's mom had screamed. "The kind that wants that man to get loaded and do it again, that's who. A God who loves drunks and hates little boys." Brian, looking up with his absent eyes, harking to his mother's sermon with a waxy ear, not noticing, not here. But, "Yes," something whispered. "Yes, he is. He is. Somewhere." "Nurse, can you give my wife a shot?" Mr. Ross had asked. By then, he was having a hard time keeping her from leaping back across the room and grabbing David, her son, maybe both of them. Something in her head had broken free. It was something that had a lot to say. "I'll get Dr. Burgoyne. He's just up the hall." She hurried out. Brian's dad gave David a strained smile. There was sweat trickling down his cheeks and standing out on his forehead in a galaxy of fine dots. His eyes were red, and to David, he looked like he had already lost weight. David didn't think such a thing was possible, but that was how he had looked. Mr. Ross now had one arm around his wife's waist and his other hand clamped on her shoulder. "You have to go now, David," Mr. Ross said. He was trying not to pant, and panting a little anyway. We're not doing so good." "But I didn't say goodbye to him," David wanted to say, and then realized it wasn't sweat trickling down Mr. Ross's cheeks, but tears. That got him moving. It wasn't until he got to the door and turned back and saw Mr. and Mrs. Ross had blurred into a whole crowd of parents that he realized he was shortly going to be crying himself. "May I come back, Mr. Ross?" he asked in a cracked, shivery voice he barely recognized. "Tomorrow, maybe?" Mrs. Ross had stopped struggling now. Mr. Ross's hands had ended up locked together just below her breasts, and her head was bent so her hair hung in her face. The way they looked made David think of the World Federation wrestling matches he and Bri had also sometimes watched, and how sometimes one guy would hug another guy like that. "Oh, shit, the mummy's after us," David thought, for no good reason at all. Mr. Ross was shaking his head. "I don't think so, Davy." "But, no, I don't think so. You see, the doctors say there's no chance at all for Brian to... His face began to change as David had never seen an adult's face change. It seemed to be tearing itself apart from the inside. It was only later, out in the Bear Street woods, that he got a handle on it. Sort of. He'd been seeing what happened when someone who hadn't cried in a long time, years maybe, finally couldn't hold back any longer. This was what it was like when the dam burst. "Oh, my boy!" Mr. Ross screamed. "Oh, my boy!" He let go of his wife and fell back against the wall between the two red vinyl chairs. He stood there for a moment, kind of leaning, then folded at the knees. He slid down the wall until he was sitting, hands held out toward the bed, cheeks wet, snot hanging from his nostrils, hair sticking up in the back, shirt tail out, pants pulled up so you could see the tops of his socks. He sat there like that and wailed. His wife knelt by him and took him in her arms as best she could, and that was when the doctor came in with the nurse right behind him, and when David slipped out, crying hard but trying not to sob. They were in a hospital, after all, and some people were trying to get well. His father was as pale as his mother had been when she told him about Brian, and when he took David's hand, his skin was much colder than Brian's had been.
"I'm sorry you had to see that," his father said as they waited for the world's slowest elevator.
David had an idea it was all he could think of to say. On the ride home, Ralph Carver started to speak twice, then stopped. He turned on the radio, found an oldie station, then turned it down to ask David if he wanted an ice cream soda or anything. David shook his head, and his father turned the music up again, louder than ever. When they got home, David told his father he thought he'd shoot some baskets in the driveway. His father said that was fine, then hurried inside. As David stood behind the crack in the hot top that he used as a foul line, he heard his parents in the kitchen, their voices drifting out of the open window over the sink. She wanted to know what had happened, how David had taken it.
"Well, there was a scene," his father said, as though Brian's coma and approaching death were part of some play.
David tuned out. That sense of otherness had come on him again, that feeling of being small, a part instead of a whole, someone else's business. He suddenly felt very strongly that he wanted to go down to the Bear Street woods, down to the little clearing. A path, narrow, but you could ride bikes along it if you went single file, led into this clearing. It was here, up in the Viet Cong lookout, that the boys had tried one of Debbie Ross's cigarettes the year before and found it awful. Here that they had looked through their first copy of Penthouse. Brian had seen it lying on top of the dumpster behind the Easy Stop 24 down the hill from his house. Here that they had hung their feet down and had their long conversations and dreamed their dreams, mostly about how they were going to be the kings of West Wentworth Middle School when they were ninth graders. It was here, in the clearing you got to by way of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, that the boys had most enjoyed their friendship, and it was here that David suddenly felt he had to go. He had bounced the ball, with which he and Brian had played about a billion games of horse, one final time, bent his knees and shot. Swish. Nothing but net. When the ball returned to him, he tossed it into the grass. His folks were still in the kitchen, their voices still droning out the open window, but David didn't even think about poking his head in and telling them where he was going. They might have forbidden him. Taking his bike never occurred to him. He walked, head down, the bright blue, excused early pass still sticking out of his shirt pocket, although school was over for the day by then. The big yellow buses were rolling their homeward routes. Yelling flocks of little kids pounded past, waving their papers and lunchboxes. David took no notice. His mind was elsewhere. Later, Reverend Martin would tell him about the still small voice of God, and David would feel a tug of recognition, but it hadn't seemed like a voice then, or a thought, or even an intuition. The idea his mind kept returning to was how, when you were thirsty, your whole body cried for water, and how you would eventually lie down and drink from a mud puddle if that was all you could get. He came to Bear Street, then to the Ho Chi Minh Trail. He walked slowly down it, his head still lowered, so that he looked like a scholar with his mind on some immense problem. The Ho Chi Minh hadn't been his and Brian's exclusive property. Lots of kids ordinarily used it on their way to and from school. But no one had been on it that warm fall afternoon. It seemed to have been cleared especially for him. Halfway to the clearing, he spotted a Three Musketeers candy bar wrapper and picked it up. It was the only kind of candy bar Brian would eat. He called them Three Muskies, and David had no doubt that Brian had dropped this one beside the path a day or two before the accident. Not that Brian was ordinarily a litterbug sort of guy. He'd stuff the wrapper in his pocket under ordinary circumstances, but... But maybe something made him drop it. Something that knew I'd come along after that car hit him and threw him and broke his head on the bricks. Something that knew I'd find it and remember him. He told himself that was crazy, absolutely nutzoid, but maybe the nuttiest thing of all was that he didn't really think it was. Perhaps it would sound nutty if spoken aloud, but inside his head it seemed perfectly logical. With no thought of what he was doing, David stuck the red and silver wrapper into his mouth and sucked the little bits of sweet chocolate off the inside. He did this with his eyes closed and fresh tears squeezing out from under the lids. When the chocolate was all gone and there was nothing left but the taste of wet paper, he spat the wrapper out and went on his way. At the east edge of the clearing was an oak with two thick branches spreading out in a V about 20 feet up. The boys hadn't quite dared go the whole hog and build a treehouse in this beckoning fork. Someone might notice and make them tear it down again. But they had brought boards, hammers, and nails down here one summer day a year ago and made a platform that still remained. David and Brian knew that the high school kids sometimes used it. They had found cigarette butts and beer cans on the weather-darkened old boards from time to time, and once a pair of pantyhose. But never until after dark, it seemed, and the idea of big kids using something they had made was actually sort of flattering. Also, the first handholds you had to grab in order to make the climb were high enough to discourage the little kids. David went up, cheeks wet, eyes swollen, still tasting chocolate and wet paper in his mouth, still hearing the gasp of the accordion thing in his ears. He felt he would find some other sign of Brian on the platform, like the Three Muskies wrapper on the path, but there was nothing. Just the sign nailed to the tree, the one that said, Viet Cong Lookout, which they had put up a couple of weeks after completing the platform. The inspiration for that, and for the name they'd given the path, was some old movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger in it. David didn't remember the name. He kept expecting to come up here someday and find that the big kids had pulled the sign down or spray-painted something like, Suck My Dick, on it. But none ever had. He guessed they must like it, too. A breeze soughed through the trees, cooling his hot skin. Any other day and Brian would have been sharing that breeze with him. They would have been dangling their feet, talking, laughing. David started to cry again. Why am I here? No answer. Why did I come? Did something make me come? No answer. If anyone's there, please answer. No answer for a long time. And then one did come, and he didn't think he was just talking to himself inside his own head, then fooling himself about what he was doing in order to gain a little comfort. As when he had stood over Brian, the thought which came seemed in no way his own. Yes, this voice had said, I'm here. Who are you? Who I am, the voice said, and then fell silent, as if that actually explained something. David crossed his legs, sitting tailor fashion in the middle of the platform, and closed his eyes. He cupped his knees in his palms and opened his mind as best he could. He had no idea what else to do. In this fashion he waited for an unknown length of time, hearing the distant voices of the home-going children, aware of shifting red and black shapes on the insides of his eyelids as the breeze moved the branches above him and dapples of sunlight slipped back and forth on his face. "Tell me what you want," he asked the voice. No answer. The voice didn't seem to want anything. Tell me what to do, then. No answer from the voice. Distant, distant, he heard the sound of the firehouse whistle over on Columbus Broad. It was 5 o'clock. He had been sitting up on the platform with his eyes closed for at least an hour, probably more like 2. His mom and dad would have noticed he was no longer in the driveway, would have seen the ball lying in the grass, would be worried. He loved them and didn't want to worry them. On some level, he understood that Brian's impending death had struck at them as hard as it had struck at him. But he couldn't go home yet, because he wasn't done yet. "Do you want me to pray?" he asked the voice. I'll try if you want me to, but I don't know how. We don't go to church, and... The voice overrode his, not angry, not amused, not impatient, not anything he could read. You're praying already, it said. What should I pray for? Oh, shit, the mummy's after us, the voice said. Let's all walk a little faster. I don't know what that means.
Yes, you do.
No, I don't.
Yes, I do, he said, almost moaned.
Yes, I do. It means ask for what none of them dare to ask for. Pray for what none of them dare to pray for. Is that it?
No answer from the voice.
David opened his eyes, and the afternoon bombed him with late light, the red-gold glow of November. His legs were numb from the knees down, and he felt as if he had just awakened from a deep sleep. The day's simple, unzipped loveliness stunned him, and for a moment he was very aware of himself as a part of something whole, a cell on the living skin of the world. He lifted his hands from his knees, turned them over, and held them out.
Make him better, he said. God, make him better. If you do, I'll do something for you. I'll listen for what you want, and then I'll do it. I promise.
He didn't close his eyes, but listened carefully, waiting to see if the voice had anything more to say. At first, it seemed it did not. He lowered his hands, started to stand up, then winced at the burst of pins and needles that went whooshing up his legs from the balls of his feet. He even laughed a little. He grabbed a branch to steady himself, and as he was doing this, the voice did speak again. David listened, head cocked, still holding the branch, still feeling his muscles tingle crazily as the blood worked its way back into them. Then he nodded. They had put 3 nails into the trunk of the tree to hold the Viet Cong lookout sign. The wood had shrunk and warped since then, and the rusty heads of the nails stuck out. David took the blue pass with "Excused Early" printed on it from his shirt pocket and poked it onto one of the nail heads. That done, he marched in place until the tingling in his legs began to subside, and he trusted himself to climb back down the tree. He went home. He hadn't even gotten to the driveway before his parents were out the kitchen door. Ellen Carver stood on the stoop, hand raised to her forehead to shade her eyes, while Ralph almost ran down the sidewalk to meet him and grab him by the shoulders.
Where were you? Where in the hell were you, David?
I went for a walk, into the Bear Street woods. I was thinking about Brian.
Well, you scared the devil out of us, his mom said.
Kirsten joined her on the stoop. She was eating a bowl of Jell-O and had her favorite doll, Melissa's sweetheart, tucked under her arm.
Even Kirsty was worried, weren't you?
Nope, Pye said, and went on eating her Jell-O.
Are you all right? His father had asked.
Yes.
Are you sure?
Yes. He went into the house, yanking on one of Pye's braids as he went past her. Pye wrinkled her nose at him, then smiled.
Supper's almost ready. Go wash up, Ellen said.
The telephone started to ring. She went to answer it, then called sharply to David as he headed for the downstairs bathroom to wash his hands, which had been pretty dirty. Sticky, sappy, tree-climbing dirty. He turned and saw his mom holding out the telephone in one fist while she twisted the other restlessly in her apron. She tried to talk, but at first no sound came out when her lips moved. She swallowed and tried again.
It's Debbie Ross, for you. She's crying. I think it must be over. For God's sake, be kind to her.
David crossed the room and took the phone. That feeling of otherness had swept over him again. He had been sure his mom was at least half right. Something was over.
Hello, he said. Mrs. Ross?
She was crying so hard that at first she couldn't talk. She tried, but what came through her sobs was just wah, wah, wah. From a little distance, he heard Mr. Ross say, "Let me do it." And Mrs. Ross said, "No, I'm okay." There was a mighty honk in David's ear. It sounded like a hungry goose. And then she said, "Brian's awake." "Is he?" David said. What she had just said made him feel happier than he had ever been in his life, and yet it had not surprised him at all. "Is he dead?" Ellen was mouthing at him. One hand was still plunged deep into her apron, twisting and turning. "No," David said, putting his hand over the mouthpiece to talk to his mother and father. It was all right. He could do that. Debbie Ross was sobbing again. He thought she'd do that every time she told anyone, at least for a while. She wouldn't be able to help it, because her heart had given him up. "Is he dead?" Ellen mouthed again. "No," he told her, a little irritated. It was like she was deaf. "Not dead, alive. She says he's awake." His mother and father gaped like fish in an aquarium. Pi went past them, still eating Jell-O, her face turned down to the face of her doll, which was sticking stiffly out from the crook of her arm. "Told you this would happen," she said to Melissa's sweetheart, in a forbidding, "this closes the discussion" tone of voice. "Didn't I say so?" "Awake," David's mother had said in a stunned, musing voice. "Alive." "David, are you there?" Mrs. Ross asked. "Yes," he said, "right here." "About 20 minutes after you left, the EEG monitor started to show waves. I saw them first. Mark was down in the caf getting sodas, and I went to the nurse's station. They didn't believe me." She laughed through her tears. "Well, of course, who would? And when I finally got someone to come look, they called maintenance instead of a doctor. That's how sure they were that it couldn't be happening. They actually replaced the monitor. Isn't that the most amazing thing you ever heard?" "Yes," David said. "Wild." Both parents were mouthing at him now, and his dad was also making big hand gestures. To David, he looked like an insane asylum inmate who thought he was a game show host. That made him want to laugh. He didn't want to do that while he was on the phone. Mrs. Ross wouldn't understand, so he turned and faced the wall. It wasn't until they saw the same high waves on the new monitor, only even stronger, that one of the nurses called Dr. Wasluski. He's the neurologist. Before he got here, Brian opened his eyes and looked around at us. He asked me if I'd fed the goldfish today. I said yes, the goldfish were fine. I didn't cry or anything. I was too stunned to cry. Then he said his head ached and closed his eyes again. When Dr. Wasluski came in, Brian looked like he was still in the coma, and I saw him give the nurse a look like, "Why do you bother me with this? You know?" "Sure," David said. But when the doctor clapped his hands beside Brian's ear, he opened his eyes again right away. "You should have seen that old Pollock's face, Davy." She laughed, the cracked, cackling laugh of a madwoman. Then Brian said he was thirsty and asked if he could have a drink of water. She broke down entirely then, her sobs so loud in his ear that they almost hurt. Then they faded, and Bri's dad said, "David, you still there?" He sounded none too steady himself, but he wasn't outright bawling, which was a relief. "Sure." Brian doesn't remember the accident, doesn't remember anything after doing his homework in his room the night before it happened, but he remembers his name and his address and our names. He knows who the president is, and he can do simple math problems. Dr. Wasluski says he's heard of cases like this, but never actually seen one. He called it a clinical miracle. I don't know if that actually means anything, or if it's just something he's always wanted to say, and I don't care. I just want to thank you, David. So does Debbie, from the bottom of our hearts. "Me?" David asked. A hand was tugging his shoulder, trying to get him to turn around. He resisted it. "What are you thanking me for?"
for bringing Brian back to us. You were talking to him. The waves started showing up just after you left. He heard you, Davy. He heard you and came back.
It wasn't me, David said.
He turned around. His folks were all but looming over him, their faces frantic with hope, amazement, confusion. His mother was crying. What a day for tears it had been. Only Pi, who usually bawled at least 6 hours out of every 24, seemed to have her shit together.
I know what I know, Mr. Ross said. I know what I know, David.
He had to talk to his parents before they stared at him so hard they set his shirt on fire. But before he did, there was one other thing he had to know. What time did he wake up and ask about his goldfish? How long after you started seeing his brain waves?
Well, they changed the monitor. She told you that. And then, I don't know.
He trailed off for a moment, then said, Yes, I do. I remember hearing the Columbus Broad fire whistle just before everything happened, so it must have been a few minutes past 5.
David had nodded, unsurprised. Right around the time the voice in his head had told him, You're praying already.
Can I come and see him tomorrow?
Mr. Rawson laughed then.
David, you can come see him at midnight, if that's what you want.
Why not? Dr. Wasluski says we have to keep waking him up anyway and asking him stupid questions. I know what he's afraid of, that Brian will slip back into the coma, but I don't think that's going to happen. Do you?
Nope, David said.
Bye, Mr. Ross.
He'd hung up the telephone then, and his parents all but pounced on him. How did it happen, they wanted to know. How did it happen, and what did they think you had to do with it?
David felt an urge then, an amazingly strong one, to cast his eyes down modestly and say, Well, he woke up, that's really all I know, except, well...
He would pause with seeming reluctance, then add, Mr. and Mrs. Ross think he might have heard my voice and responded to it, but you know how upset they've been.
That's all it would take to start a legend. Part of him knew it. And he wanted to do it. Part of him really, really wanted to do it.
It wasn't the strange inside-out voice that stopped him, but a thought of his own, one that was more intuited than articulated.
If you take the credit, it stops here.
What stops?
Everything that matters, the voice of intuition responded. Everything that matters.
David, come on, his father said, giving his shoulders a little shake. We're dying here.
Brian's awake, he said, choosing his words carefully. He can talk. He can remember. The brain guy says it's a miracle. Mr. and Mrs. Ross think I had something to do with it, that he heard me talking to him and came back, but nothing like that happened. I was holding his hand and he wasn't there. He was the most gone person I ever saw in my life. That's why I cried. Not because his folks were having a fit, but because he was gone. I don't know what happened, and I don't care. He's awake. That's all I care about.
That's all you need to care about, darling, his mother said, and gave him a brief, hard hug.
I'm hungry, he said. What's for supper?
3. Now he hung in the black, blind but not deaf, listening for the voice, the one Reverend Gene Martin called the still, small voice of God. Reverend Martin had listened carefully to David's story not once but many times over the last 7 months, and he seemed especially pleased by David's recounting of how he had felt during the conversation with his parents after he had finished talking with Mr. Ross.
You were completely correct, Reverend Martin had said. It wasn't another voice you heard at the end, especially not the voice of God, except in the sense that God always speaks to us through our consciences. Secular people, David, believe that the conscience is only a kind of censor, a place where social sanctions are stored. But in fact, It is itself a kind of outsider, often guiding us to good solutions, even in situations far beyond our understanding. Do you follow me?
I think so.
You didn't know why it was wrong to take the credit for your friend's recovery, but you didn't need to. Satan tempted you as he tempted Moses, but in this case, you did what Moses didn't or couldn't. First understood, then withstood. What about Moses? What did he do?
Reverend Martin had told him the story of how, when the Israelites he'd led out of Egypt were thirsty, Moses had struck a stone with Aaron's staff and brought water gushing out of it. And when the Israelites asked to whom their thanks should be directed, Moses said they could thank him. Reverend Martin sipped from a teacup with "happy, joyous, and free" printed on the side as he told this story, but what was in the cup didn't exactly smell like tea to David. It smelled more like the whiskey his dad sometimes drank while watching the late news.
Just one little misstep in a long, hard-working life in the service of the Lord, Reverend Martin said cheerfully, but God kept him out of the promised land for it. Joshua led him across the river. Nasty, ungrateful bunch that they were. This conversation had taken place on a Sunday afternoon in June. By then, the two of them had known each other for quite a while and grown comfortable with each other. David had fallen into the habit of going to church in the morning, then walking over to the Methodist parsonage on Sunday afternoon, and talking with Reverend Martin for an hour or so in his study. David looked forward to these meetings, and Jean Martin did too. He was immensely taken with the child, who seemed at one moment an ordinary boy, and at the next, someone much older than his years. And there was something else. He believed that David Carver had been touched by God, and that God's touch might not yet have departed. He was fascinated with the story of Brian Ross, and by how what had happened to Brian had caused David, a perfect late 20th century religious illiterate, to seek answers, to seek God. He told his wife that David was the only honest convert he had ever seen, and that what had happened to David's friend was the only modern miracle he'd ever heard of that he could actually believe in. Brian had turned out fine and dandy, except for a slight limp, and the doctor said even that might be gone in a year or so.
Marvelous, Stella Martin replied. That will be a comfort to me and the baby if your young friend says the wrong thing about his religious instruction and you wind up in court, facing child abuse charges. You have to be careful, Jean, and you're crazy to be drinking around him.
I'm not drinking around him, Reverend Martin had replied, suddenly finding something interesting to look at out the window. At last he returned his eyes to his wife. As to the other, the Lord is my shepherd. He went on seeing David on Sunday afternoons. He was not quite 30 himself in discovering for the first time the pleasures of writing on a perfectly blank slate. He didn't quit mixing Seagram's with his tea, a Sunday afternoon tradition of long standing, but he left the study door open whenever he and David were together. The TV was always on during their conversations, always punched to mute and tuned to the various Sunday afternoon athletic contests. Soundless football when David first came to Reverend Martin, then soundless basketball, then soundless baseball. It was during a soundless baseball game between the Indians and the A's that David sat mulling over the story of Moses and the water from the rock. After a while, he looked up from the TV screen and said, "God isn't very forgiving, is he?"
"Yes, indeed he is," Reverend Martin said, sounding a little surprised. "He has to be, because he is so demanding."
"But he's cruel, too, isn't he?" Jean Martin hadn't hesitated. "Yes," he said, "God is cruel. I have popcorn, David. Would you like me to make some?" Now he floated in the black, listening for Reverend Martin's cruel God, the one who had refused Moses entry into Canaan because Moses had one single time claimed God's work as his own, the one who had used him in some fashion to save Brian Ross, the one who had then killed his sweet little sister and put the rest of them in the hands of a giant lunatic who had the empty eyes of a coma patient. There were other voices in the dark place where he went when he prayed. He heard them frequently while he was there, usually distant, like the dim voices you sometimes heard in the background when you made a long-distance call, sometimes more clearly. Today, one of them was very clear indeed. "If you want to pray, pray to me," it said. "Why would you pray to a God who kills baby sisters? You'll never laugh at how funny she is again, or tickle her until she squeals, or pull her braids. She's dead, and you and your folks are in jail. When he comes back, the crazy cop, he'll probably kill all three of you, the others as well. This is what your God did, and really, what else would you expect from a God who kills baby sisters? He's as crazy as the cop when you get right down to cases. Yet you kneel before him. Come on, Davy, get a life. Get a grip. Pray to me. At least I'm not crazy." He wasn't rocked by this voice. Not very, anyway. He'd heard it before, perhaps first wrapped inside that strong impulse to give his folks the impression that he had called Brian back from the deep reaches of his coma. He heard it more clearly, more personally, during his daily prayers, and this had troubled him. But when he told Reverend Martin about how that voice would sometimes cut in, as if it were on a telephone extension, Reverend Martin had only laughed. "Like God, Satan tends to speak to us most clearly in our prayers and meditations," he said. "It's when we're most open, most in touch with our pneuma." "Pneuma? What's that?" "Spirit. The part of you that yearns to fulfill its God-made potential and be eternal. The part that God and Satan are squabbling over even now." He had taught David a little mantra to use at such times, and he used it now. "See in me, be in me," he thought, over and over again. He was waiting for the voice of the other to fade, but he also needed to get above the pain again. It kept coming back like cramps. Thinking about what had happened to Pi hurt so deep. And yes, he did resent God for letting the insane cop push her down those stairs. Resented, hell, hated. "See in me, God. Be in me, God. See in me, be in me." The voice of Satan, if it was indeed him, David didn't know for sure, faded away, and for a while there was only the dark. "Tell me what to do, God. Tell me what you want. And if it's your will that we should die here, help me not to waste time being mad or being scared or yelling for an explanation." Distant, the howl of a coyote. Then, nothing. He waited, trying to stay open, and still there was nothing. At last he gave up and spoke the prayer-ending words that Reverend Martin had taught him, muttering them into his clasped hands. "Lord, make me useful to myself and help me to remember that until I am, I can't be useful to others. Help me to remember that you are my creator. I am what you made, sometimes the thumb on your hand, sometimes the tongue in your mouth. Make me a vessel which is whole to your service. Thanks. Amen." He opened his eyes. As always, he first stared into the blackness in the center of his clasped hands, and as always, the first thing it reminded him of was an eye, a hole like an eye. Whose, though? God's? The devil's? Perhaps just his own? He stood up, turned slowly around, looked at his parents. They were looking back at him, Ellie amazed, Ralph grave. "Well, thank heaven," his mother said. She gave him a chance to reply, and when he didn't, she asked, "Were you praying? You were down on your knees almost half an hour. I thought you must have gone to sleep. Were you praying?"
"Yes."
"Do you do it all the time, or is this a special case?"
"I do it 3 times a day, in the morning, at night, and once somewhere in the middle. The middle one I use to say thanks for all the good things in my life, and ask for help with the stuff I don't understand."
He laughed, a small, nervous sound.
There's always plenty of that. Is this a recent development, or have you been doing it since you started going to that church? She was still looking at him with a perplexity that made David feel self-conscious. Part of it was the black eye. She was developing a hell of a shiner from where the cop had hit her. But that wasn't all of it, or even most of it. She was looking at him as if she had never seen him before. "He's been doing it since Brian's accident," Ralph said. He touched the swollen place over his left eye, winced, and dropped his hand again. He stared at David through two sets of bars, looking as self-conscious as David felt. "I came upstairs to kiss you goodnight this one time. It was a few days after they let Brian go home. And I saw you down on your knees at the foot of your bed. At first I thought you might be, well, I don't know, doing something else. Then I heard some of what you were saying and understood." David smiled, feeling a blush heat his cheeks. That was pretty absurd under the circumstances, but there it was. "I do it in my head now. I don't even move my lips. A couple of kids heard me mumbling to myself one day in study hall and thought I was going feeble." "Maybe your father understands, but I don't," Ellen said. "I talk to God," he said. This was embarrassing, but maybe if it was said once and right out straight, it wouldn't have to be said again. "That's what praying is, talking to God. At first it feels like talking to yourself, but then it changes." "Is that something you know for yourself, David, or is it something your new Sunday pal told you?"
"Something I know for myself."
"And does God answer?"
"Sometimes I think I hear him," David said. He reached into his pocket and touched the shotgun shell with the tips of his fingers. "And once, I know I did. I asked him to let Brian be all right. After Dad took me to the hospital, I went to the Bear Street woods and climbed to the platform me and Bri made in the tree there and asked God to let him be all right. I said that if he did that, I'd kind of give him an IOU. Do you know what I mean?"
"Yes, David. I know what an IOU is. And has he collected on it? This God of yours?"
"Not yet. But when I got up to climb back down the tree, God told me to put my excused early pass on a nail that was sticking out of the bark up there. It was like he wanted me to turn it in, only to him instead of Mrs. Hardy in the office. And something else, he wanted me to find out as much as I could about him. What he is, what he wants, what he does, and what he won't do. I didn't exactly hear that in words, but I heard the name of the man he wanted me to go to, Reverend Martin. That's why I go to the Methodist Church. I don't think the brand name matters much to God, though. He just said to do church for my heart and spirit, and Reverend Martin for my mind. I didn't even know who Reverend Martin was at first."
"But you did," Ellie Carver said. She spoke in the soft, soothing voice of a person who suddenly understands that the person she's talking with is having mental problems. "Gene Martin has come to the house 2 or 3 years in a row to collect for African Relief."
"Really? I didn't see him. I guess I must have been in school when he came."
"Nonsense," his mother said, now in tones of absolute finality. "He would have come near Christmas, so you wouldn't have been in school. Now listen to me, David, very carefully. When the stuff with Brian happened, you must have, well, I don't know, thought you needed outside help. And your subconscious dredged up the only name it knew. The God you heard in your moment of bereavement was your subconscious mind, looking for answers." She turned to Ralph and spread her hands. "The obsessive Bible reading was bad enough, but this, why didn't you tell me about this praying business?"
"Because it looked private." He shrugged, not meeting her eyes. "And it wasn't hurting anybody."
"Oh, no. Praying is great. Without it, the thumbscrews and the Iron Maiden probably never would have been invented." This was a voice David had heard before, a nervous, hectoring voice that his mother adopted when she was trying to keep from breaking down completely. It was the way she'd spoken to him and his dad when Brian had been in the hospital. She had gone on in that vein for a week or so, even after Brian came around. David's father turned away from her, stuffing his hands in his pockets and looking nervously down at the floor. That seemed to make her more furious than ever.
She swung back to David, mouth working, eyes shiny with new tears.
What kind of deal did he make with you, this wonderful God? Was it like one of the baseball card trades you do with your buds? Did he say, hey, I'll trade you this neat Brian Ross, 84, for this Kirsty Carver, 88? Was it like that, or more like...
Lady, he's your boy, and I don't mean to interfere, but why don't you give it a rest? I guess you lost your little girl. I lost my husband. We've all had a tough day.
It was the woman who had shot at the cop. She was sitting on the end of the bunk. Her black hair hung against her cheeks like limp wings, but did not obscure her face. She looked shocked and stricken and tired. Most of all, tired. David couldn't remember ever having seen such a weary pair of eyes. He thought for a moment that his mother would turn her rage on the dark-haired woman. It wouldn't have surprised him. She sometimes went nuclear with total strangers. He remembered once, when he had been about 6, she'd flamed a political candidate trolling for votes outside their neighborhood supermarket. The guy had made the tactical mistake of trying to hand her a leaflet when she had an armload of groceries and was late for an appointment. She had turned on him like some small, biting animal, asking him who he thought he was, what he thought he stood for, what his position was on the trade deficit. Had he ever smoked pot? Had he ever in his life converted the 6-10 split? Did he support a woman's right to choose? On that last one, the guy had been emphatic. He did support a woman's right to choose, he told Ellen Carver proudly. Good. Great. Because I choose right now to tell you to get the holy hell out of my face, she had screamed. And that was when the guy had simply turned tail and fled. David hadn't blamed him either. But something in the dark-haired woman's face. Mary, he thought. Her name is Mary. Changed his mother's mind if blowing up had indeed been on it. She focused on David again instead.
So, any word from the big G on how we're supposed to get out of this? You were on your knees long enough. There must have been some sort of message.
Ralph turned back to her. Quit riding him, he growled. Just quit it. Do you think you're the only one who's hurting?
She gave him a look which was perilously close to contempt.
Well?
No. No message.
Someone's coming, Mary said sharply. There was a window behind her bunk. She stood on the bunk and tried to look out. Shit! Bars and frosted glass with goddamn chicken wire in it. But I hear it. I do.
David heard it, too. An approaching motor. Suddenly it revved up, blatting at full power. The sound was accompanied by a scream of tires. He looked around at the old man. The old man shrugged and raised his hands, palms up. David heard what might have been a yell of pain, and then another scream. Human this time. It would be better to think it had been a scream of wind caught in a gutter or a downspout, but he thought it had almost certainly been human.
What the hell? Ralph said. Jesus! Someone's screaming his head off. Is it the cop, do you think?
God, I hope so, Mary cried fiercely, still standing on the bunk and peering at the useless window. I hope someone's pulling the son of a bitch's lungs right out of his chest.
She looked around at them. Her eyes were still tired, but now they looked wild as well.
It could be help. Have you thought of that? It could be help.
The engine, not too close, but by no means distant, revved. The tires screamed again, screamed the way they did in the movies and on TV, but hardly ever in real life. Then there was a crunching sound. Wood, metal, maybe both. A brief honk, as if someone had inadvertently struck the car's horn. A coyote howl rose, wavering and glassy. It was joined by another, and another, and another. They seemed to be mocking the dark-haired woman's idea of help. Now the motor was approaching, rumbling at a sedate level just above an idle. The man with the white hair was sitting at the foot of the cell's bunk, his hands pressed together finger to finger between his thighs.
He talked without raising his eyes from his hands.
Don't get your hopes up.
His voice sounded as cracked and dusty as the salt flats west and north of here.
Ain't nobody but him. I recognize the sound of the motor.
I refuse to believe that, Ellie Carver said flatly.
Refuse all you want, the old man said. It don't matter. I was on the committee that approved the money for a new town cruiser. Just before I finished my term and retired from politics, that was. I went over to Carson City last November with Collie and Dick, and we bought it at a DEA auction, that very car. I had my head under the hood before we bid on her and drove her halfway home at speeds varying from 65 to 110. I recognize her all right. It's Arn.
And as David turned to look at the old man, the still, small voice, the one he had first heard in Brian's hospital room, spoke to him. As usual, its arrival came pretty much as a surprise, and the two words it spoke made no immediate sense. The soap. He heard the words as clearly as he had heard, "You're praying already," while he had been sitting in the Viet Cong lookout with his eyes closed. The soap. He looked into the left rear corner of the cell he was sharing with old Mr. Whitehair. There was a toilet with no seat. Beside it was an ancient, rust-stained porcelain sink. Sitting beside the right-hand spigot was a green bar of what could only be Irish spring soap. Outside, the engine sound of the desperation police cruiser grew fatter and closer. A little farther off, the coyotes howled. To David, that howling had begun to sound like the laughter of lunatics after the keepers have decamped the asylum.
4.
The Carver family had been too distraught and too focused on their captor to notice the dead dog hung from the Welcome to Town sign, but John Merrinville was a trained noticer, and in truth, the dog was now hard to miss. Since the Carvers had passed this way, the buzzards had found it. They sat on the ground below the carcass, the ugliest birds Johnny had ever seen, one pulling on old Chep's tail, the other gnawing at one of his dangling feet. The body swung back and forth on the rope twisted around its neck. Johnny made a sound of disgust. "Buzzards," the cop said. "Gosh, aren't they something?" His voice had thickened a great deal. He had sneezed twice more on the ride in from town, and the second time there had been teeth in the blood he sprayed out of his mouth. Johnny didn't know what was happening to him and didn't care. He only wished it would hurry up. "I'll tell you something about buzzards," the cop continued. "They wake to sleep and take their waking slow. They learn by going where they have to go. Wouldn't you agree, mon capitaine?" A lunatic cop who quoted poetry, how Sartre. "Whatever you say, officer." He had no intention of antagonizing the cop again if he could help it. The guy seemed to be self-destructing, and Johnny wanted to be around when the process was over. They rolled past the dead dog and the grisly, skin-looking things dining on it. "What about the coyotes, Johnny? What was up with them?" But he wouldn't let himself think about the coyotes, lined up along both sides of the road at neat intervals like an honor guard, or of how they had peeled off like the blue angels as soon as the cruiser passed, running back into the desert as if their heads were on fire and their asses were catching. "They fart, you know," the cop said in his blood-soaked voice. "Buzzards fart."
"No, I didn't know that."
"Yes, sir. Only birds that do. I tell you so you can put it in your book. Chapter 16 of Travels with Harley."
Johnny thought the putative title of his book had never sounded so quintessentially stupid. They were now passing a trailer park. Johnny saw a sign in front of one rusty, roof-sagging double-wide which read, "I'm a gun-totin', snapple-drinkin', Bible-readin', Clinton-bashin' son of a bitch. Never mind the dog, beware of the owner."
Welcome to country music hell, Johnny thought. The cruiser rolled past a mining company building. There were quite a few cars and pickups in the parking lot, which struck Johnny as peculiar. It was past quitting time now, and not by a little. Why weren't these cars in their own driveways, or down in front of the local watering hole? Yep, yep, the cop said. He lifted one hand, as if to frame a picture. I can see it now. Chapter 16, The Farting Buzzards of Desperation. Sounds like a goddamn Edgar Rice Burroughs novel, doesn't it? Burroughs was a better writer than you, though, and do you know why? Because he was a hack without pretensions, one with priorities. Tell the story, do the work, give the people something they can enjoy without feeling too stupid, and stay out of the gossip columns. Where are you taking me? Johnny asked, striving for a neutral tone. Jail, the big cop said in his stuffy, liquid voice, where anything you bray will be abused against you in a sort of caw. He leaned forward, wincing at the pain in his back where the cop had kicked him. You need help, he said. He tried to keep his voice non-accusatory, even gentle. Do you know that, officer? You're the one who needs help, the cop replied. Spiritual, physical, and editorial. Tack! But no help is going to come, Big John. You've eaten your last literary lunch and fucked your last culture cunt. You're on your own in the wilderness, and this is going to be the longest 40 days and 40 nights of your entire useless life. The words rang in his head like the peal of some sickly bell. Johnny closed his eyes for a moment, then opened them again. They were in the town proper now, passing Gale's Beauty Bar on one side and True Value Hardware on the other. There was nobody on the sidewalks. Absolutely nobody. He'd never seen a small western town that was actually bustling, but this was ridiculous. No one at all? As they passed the Conoco station, he saw a guy in the office, rocked back in his chair with his feet up on the desk, but that was it. Except up ahead, a pair of animals went trotting lazily across what appeared to be the town's only intersection, moving on a diagonal beneath the blinker light. Johnny tried to tell himself they were dogs, but they weren't dogs. They were coyotes. It's not all the cop, Johnny. Don't you think it is? Something not normal is going on here. Something very much not normal. As they reached the intersection, the cop slammed on the brakes. Johnny, not expecting it, was thrown forward into the mesh between the front and back seats. He hit his nose and bellowed with surprised pain. The cop took no notice of him. Billy Rancourt, he cried, delighted. Damn, that's Billy Rancourt. I wondered where he got off to. Drunk in the basement of the Broken Drum. I bet you that's where he was. Dollars to donuts. Big balls, Billy. Damn if it's not. My nose, Johnny cried. It had started bleeding again, and he once more sounded like a human foghorn. Oh, Christ, it hurts. Shut up, you baby, the cop said. Gosh, aren't you spleeny? He backed up a little, then turned the cruiser so it was facing west on the cross street. He cranked his window down and poked his head out. The nape of his neck was now the color of age-darkened bricks, badly blistered, crisscrossed with cracks. Bright lines of blood filled some of these. Billy! The cop yelled. Yo, you Billy Rancourt! Hey, you old cuss! The western end of Desperation appeared to be a residential section, dusty and dispirited, but maybe a cut or two above the trailer park. Through his watering eyes, Johnny saw a man in blue jeans and a cowboy hat standing in the center of the street. He had been looking at two bicycles which sat there upside down with their wheels sticking up. There had been three, but the smallest, a candy pink little girl's bike, had fallen over in the strengthening wind. The wheels of the other two spun madly. Now this fellow looked up, saw the cruiser, waved hesitantly, then started toward them. The cop pulled his large, square head back in, He turned to look at Johnny, who understood at once that the guy out there couldn't have gotten a good look at this particular officer of the law. If he had, he would be running in the other direction right now. The cop's mouth had the sunken, infirm look of lips with no teeth to back them up, and blood ran from the corners in little streams. One of his eyes was a cauldron of gore. Except for an occasional gray flash from its swimming depths, it could have been a plucked socket. A shiny mat of blood covered the top half of his khaki shirt. "That's Billy Rancourt," he confided happily. "He cuts my hair. I've been looking for him." He lowered his voice to that register at which confidences are imparted and added, "He drinks a bit." Then he faced front, dropped the transmission into drive, and floored the accelerator. The rumbling engine howled. The tires squalled. Johnny was thrown backward, yelling with surprise. The cruiser shot forward. Johnny reached out, hooked his fingers through the mesh, and hauled himself back to a sitting position. He saw the man in the jeans and cowboy hat, Big Balls Billy Rancourt, just standing there in the street, 10 feet or so in front of the bikes, frozen, watching them come. He seemed to swell in the windshield as the cruiser ran at him. It was like watching some crazy camera trick. "No!" Johnny shrieked, beating his left hand at the mesh behind the cop's head. "No! Don't! Don't! Mister, look out!" At the last minute, Billy Rancourt understood and tried to run. He broke to his right, toward a ramshackle house squatting tiredly behind a picket fence, but it was too little and too late. He yelled, and then there was a crump as the cruiser struck him hard enough to make the frame shudder. Blood spattered the picket fence. There was a double thud from beneath the car as the wheels ran over the fallen man, and then the cruiser hit the fence and knocked it down. The big cop jammed on the brakes, bringing the cruiser to a stop in the bald dirt dooryard of the ramshackle house. Johnny was thrown forward into the mesh again, but this time he managed to get his arm up and his head down, protecting his nose. "Billy, you bugger!" the cop cried happily. "Takala!" Billy Rancourt screamed. Johnny turned in the back seat of the cruiser and saw him crawling as fast as he could toward the north side of the street. That wasn't very fast. He was trailing a broken leg. There were tread marks running across the back of his shirt and the seat of his jeans. His cowboy hat was sitting on the pavement, now turned upside down like the bicycle's. Billy Rancourt bumped it with one knee, knocking it aslant, and blood poured out over the brim like water. More blood was gushing from his split skull and broken face. He was badly hurt, but although he had been struck amidships and then run over, he didn't appear even close to dead. That didn't surprise Johnny much. Most times, it took a lot to kill a man. He had seen it again and again in Vietnam. Guys alive with half their heads blown off. Guys alive with their guts piled in their laps and drawing flies. Guys alive with their jugulars spouting through their dirty fingers. People usually died hard. That was the horror of it. "Yee-haw!" the cop yelled and dropped the cruiser's transmission into reverse. The tires screamed and smoked across the sidewalk, bounced back into the street, and ran over Billy Rancourt's cowboy hat. The cruiser's back deck hit one of the bikes. It made a hell of a bang, cracked the rear window, and then flew out of sight for a moment before coming down in front. Johnny had time to see that Billy Rancourt had stopped crawling, that he was looking back over his shoulder at them, that his blood-streaked, broken-nosed face wore an expression of unspeakable resignation. "He can't even be 30," Johnny thought, and then the man was born under the reversing car. It lurched over the body and came to a stop, idling against the far curb. The cop hit the horn with the point of his elbow, making it blip briefly, as he turned to face forward again. Ahead of the cruiser's nose, Billy Rancourt lay face down in a huge splat of blood. One of his feet twitched, then stopped.
"Whoa," the cop said. "What a damn mess, huh?"
"Yeah, you killed him," Johnny said. Suddenly he didn't care anymore about playing this guy up, outlasting him. He didn't care about the book, or his Harley, or where Steve Ames might be. Maybe later, if there was a later, he would care about some of those things, but not now. Now, in his shock and dismay, an earlier draft of himself had come out from someplace inside. A pre-edited version of Johnny Merrinville, who didn't give a shit about the Pulitzer Prize, or the National Book Award, or fucking actresses, with or without emeralds. "Ran him over in the street like a damn rabbit. Brave boy." The cop turned, gave him a considering look with his one good eye, then turned back to face the windshield again. "I have taught thee in the way of wisdom," he said. "I have led thee in the right paths. When thou goest, thy steps shall not be straightened, and when thou runnest, thou shalt not stumble." "That's from the Book of Adverbs, John. But I think old Billy stumbled. Yes, I do. He was always a gluefoot. I think that was his basic problem." Johnny opened his mouth. For one of the few times in his entire life, nothing came out. Maybe that was just as well. "Take fast hold of instruction. Let her not go. Keep her, for she is thy life." "That's a little advice you could afford to take, Mr. Merrinville, sir. Excuse me a minute." He got out and walked to the dead man in the street, his boots seeming to shimmer as the strengthening wind blew sand across them. There was a large bloody patch on the seat of his uniform pants now, and when he bent to pick up the late Billy Rancourt, Johnny saw more blood oozing out through the ripped seams under the cop's arms. It was as if he were literally sweating blood. Maybe so. Probably so. I think he's on the verge of crashing and bleeding out the way hemophiliacs sometimes do. If he wasn't so Christing big, he'd probably be dead already. You know what you have to do, don't you? Yes, of course he did. He had a bad temper, a horrible temper, and it seemed that not even getting the shit kicked out of him by a homicidal maniac had changed that. What he had to do now was keep that temper of his under control. No more cracks like calling the cop a brave boy just now. That had earned him a look Johnny hadn't liked at all. A dangerous look. The cop carried Billy Rancourt's body across the street, stepping between the two fallen bikes and past the one with its wheel still whirring and its spokes shining in the evening light. He tromped over the knocked-down piece of picket fence, climbed the steps of the house behind it, and shifted his burden so he could try the door. It opened with no trouble. Johnny wasn't surprised. He supposed that people out here did not, as a rule, bother locking their doors. "He'll have to kill the people inside," he thought. "That's pretty much automatic." But the cop only bent, offloaded his burden, then backed out onto the porch's little stoop again. He closed the door and then wiped his hands above it, leaving smears of blood on the lintel. He was so tall he didn't even have to reach to do this. The gesture gave Johnny a deep chill. It was like something out of the Book of Exodus, instructions for the angel of death to pass on by. Except this man was the angel of death, the destroyer. The cop walked back to the cruiser, got in, and drove sedately back toward the intersection. "Why'd you take him into there?" Johnny asked. "What did you want me to do?" the cop asked. His voice was thicker than ever. He seemed almost to be gargling his words. "Leave him for the buzzards? I'm ashamed of you, mon capitaine. You've been living so long with so-called civilized folk that you're starting to think like them." "The dog?" "A man is not a dog," the cop said in a prim, lecturely voice. He turned right at the intersection, then almost immediately hung a left, turning into a parking lot next to the town's municipal building. He killed the engine, got out,
and opened the right-hand rear door. That at least spared Johnny the pain and effort of sliding his banged-up body out past the sagging driver's seat. A chicken is not a chicken dinner, and a man is not a dog, Johnny. Not even a man like you. Come on, get out. Alley-zoop. Johnny got out. He was very aware of the silence. The sounds he could hear, wind, the spick-spack of alkali hitting the brick side of the municipal building, a monotonous squeaking sound from somewhere nearby, only emphasized that silence, turned it into something like a dome. He stretched, wincing at the pain in his back and leg, but needing to do something for the rest of his muscles, which were badly cramped. Then he forced himself to look up into the ruin of the cop's face. The man's height was intimidating, somehow disorienting. It wasn't just that at 6'3", Johnny was used to looking down into people's faces instead of up. It was the amount of the height differential, not an inch or two, but at least four. Then there was the breadth of the man, the sheer breadth. He didn't just stand, he loomed. "Why didn't you kill me like you did that guy back there, Billy? Or does it even make any sense to ask? Are you beyond why?" "Oh, shit. We're all beyond why. You know that," the cop said, exposing bloody teeth in a smile Johnny could have done without. "The important thing is, listen closely, I can let you go. Would you like that? You must have at least two more stupid, pointless books left in your head. Maybe as many as half a dozen. You could write a few before that thunderclap coronary that's waiting for you up the road finally takes you off. And I'm sure that, given time, you could put this interlude behind you and once more convince yourself that what you are doing somehow justifies your existence. Would you like that, Johnny? Would you like me to let you go free?" "Aaron Gobra," Johnny thought, for no reason at all, and for one nightmarish moment felt he would laugh. Then the urge was gone, and he nodded. "Yes, I'd like that very much." "Free, like a bird out of a cage." The cop flapped his arms to demonstrate, and Johnny saw that the bloody patches under his arms had spread. His uniform shirt was now stained crimson along the torn side seams almost all the way down to his belt line. "Yes." Not that he believed his new playmate had the slightest intention in the world of letting him free. Oh, no. But said playmate was shortly going to be nothing but blood sausage held together by the casing of his uniform, and if he could just remain whole and functional himself until that happened. "All right. Here's the deal, big shot. Suck my cock. Do that and I'll let you go. Straight trade." He unzipped his fly and pulled down the elastic front of his shorts. Something that looked like a dead white snake fell out. Johnny observed the thin stream of blood drizzling from it without surprise. The cop was bleeding from every other orifice, wasn't he? "Speaking in the literary sense," the cop said, grinning, "this particular blowjob is going to be a little more Anne Rice than Armistead Maupin. I suggest you follow Queen Victoria's advice. Close your eyes and think of strawberry shortcake." Johnny Merrinville looked at the maniac's prick, then up at the maniac's grinning face, then back at his prick again. He didn't know what the cop expected. Screams, revulsion, tears, melodramatic pleading. But he had a clear sense that he wasn't feeling what the cop wanted him to feel, what the cop probably thought he was feeling. "You don't seem to understand that I've seen a few worse things in my time than a cock dripping blood, not just in Vietnam either." He realized that the anger was creeping up on him again, threatening to take him over. Oh, shit, of course it was. Anger had always been his primary addiction, not whiskey or coke or lewds. Plain old rage. It didn't have anything to do with what the cop had taken out of his pants, and that might be what the guy didn't understand. It wasn't a sex issue. The thing was, Johnny Merrinville had never liked anything stuck in his face. "I'll get down on my knees in front of you if you want," he said, and although his voice was mild, something in the cop's face changed, really changed, for the first time. It blanked out somehow, except for the good eye, which narrowed suspiciously. "Why are you looking at me that way? What in the hell gives you the right to look at me that way? Tack!" "Never mind how I'm looking at you. Just hear me out, motherfucker. 3 seconds after I put that trouser rat of yours into my mouth, it's going to be lying on the pavement. You got that? Tack!" He spat this last word up into the cop's face, standing on tiptoe to do it. And for a moment, the big man looked more than surprised. He looked shocked. Then the expression tightened into a cramp of rage, and he shoved Johnny away from him so hard that for a moment he felt as if he were flying. He hit the side of the building, saw stars as the back of his head connected with rough brick, bounced back, then went sprawling when his feet tangled together. New places hurt and old places howled, but the expression he had seen on the cop's face made it all worthwhile. He looked up to see if it was still there, wanting to sample it again like a bee sampling the sweetheart of a flower, and his heart staggered in his chest. The cop's face had tautened. The skin on it now looked like makeup or a thin coat of paint. Unreal. Even the blood-filled eye looked unreal. It was as if there was another face beneath the one Johnny could see, pushing at the overlying flesh, trying to get out. The cop's good eye fixed on him for a moment, and then his head lifted. He pointed at the sky with all 5 fingers of his left hand. "Tak Allah," he said in his guttural, gargling voice. "Timo, candy latch, on, on." There was a flapping sound like clothes on a line, and a shadow fell over Johnny's face. There was a harsh cry, not quite a caw, and then something with scabrous, flapping wings dropped on him, its crooked claws gripping his shoulders and folding themselves into the fabric of his shirt, its beak digging into his scalp as it uttered its inhuman cry again. It was the smell that told Johnny what it was, a smell like meat gone feverish with rot. Its huge, unkempt wings flapped against the sides of his face as it solidified its position, driving that stench into his mouth and nose, jamming it in, making him gag. He saw the shepherd on its rope, swinging as the peeled-looking ball things pulled at its tail and feet with their beaks. Now one of them was roosting on him, one which had apparently never heard that buzzards were fundamental cowards that only attacked dead things. And its beak was plowing his scalp in furrows, bringing blood. "Get it off!" he screamed, completely unnerved. He tried to grab the wide, beating wings, but got only 2 fistfuls of feathers. Nor could he see. He was afraid that if he opened his eyes, the buzzard would shift its position and peck them out. "Jesus, please, please get it off me!" "Are you going to look at me properly if I do?" the cop asked. "No more insolence, no more disrespect?" "No, no more!" He would have promised anything. Whatever had leaped out of him and spoken against the cop was gone now. The bird had plucked it out like a worm from an ear of corn. "You promise?" The bird, flapping and squalling and pulling, smelling like green meat and exploded guts, on him, eating him alive. "Yes, yes, I promise." "Fuck you," the cop said calmly. "Fuck you, Ozpa, and fuck your promise. Take care of it yourself, or die." Eyes squeezed to slits. Kneeling, head lowered, Johnny gripped blindly for the bird, caught its wings where they joined its body, and tore it off his head. It spasmed wildly in the air above him, shitting white streams that the wind pulled away in banners, uttering its rough cry, only there was pain in it now, its head whipping from side to side.
Sobbing, mostly what he felt was revulsion, Johnny ripped one of its wings off and threw the buzzard against the wall. It stared at him with eyes as black as tar, its blood-stained beak popping open and then snapping closed with liquid little clicks. "That's my blood, you bastard," Johnny thought. He dropped the wing he'd torn off the bird and got to his feet. The buzzard tried to lurch away from him, flapping its one good wing like an oar, stirring up dust and feathers. It went in the direction of the Desperation police cruiser, but before it managed more than 5 feet, Johnny brought one motorcycle boot down on it, snapping its back. The bird's scaly legs splayed out to either side, as if it were trying to do the split. Johnny put his hands over his eyes, convinced for one moment that his mind was going to snap just as the bird's back had snapped. "Not bad," the cop said. "You got him, pard. Now turn around." "No." He stood, trembling all over, hands to his face. "Turn around." There was no denying the voice. He turned and saw the cop pointing up, once again with all 5 splayed fingers. Johnny raised his head and saw more buzzards, 2 dozen at least, sitting in a line along the north side of the parking lot, looking down at them. "Want me to call them?" the cop asked in a deceptively gentle tone of voice. "I can, you know. Birds are a hobby of mine. They'll eat you alive, if that's what I want." "No. He looked back at the cop and was relieved to see his fly was zipped again. There was a blood stain spreading across the front of his pants, though. "No, don't." "What's the magic word, Johnny?" For a moment, a horrible moment, he had no idea what the cop wanted him to say. Then it came to him. "Please." "Are you ready to be reasonable?" Yes. "I wonder about that," the cop said. He seemed to be speaking to himself. "I just wonder." Johnny stood looking at him, saying nothing. The anger was gone. Everything felt gone, replaced by a kind of deep numbness. "That boy," the cop said, looking up toward the second floor of the municipal building, where there were a number of opaque windows with bars outside them. "That boy troubles my mind. I wonder if I shouldn't talk to you about him. Perhaps you could counsel me." The cop folded his arms against his body, raised his hands, and began to tap his fingers lightly against his collarbones, much as he'd tapped them against the steering wheel earlier. He stared at Johnny as he did this. "Or maybe I should just kill you, Johnny. Maybe that would be the best thing. Once you're dead, they might award you that Nobel you've always lusted after. What do you think?" The cop raised his head to the buzzard-lined roofline of the municipal building and began to laugh. They cried harsh, cawing sounds back down to him, and Johnny was not able to stifle the thought which came to him then. It was horrible because it was so convincing. They are laughing with him because it's not his joke. It's their joke. A gust of air snapped across the parking lot, making Johnny stagger on his feet, blowing the torn-off buzzard wing across the pavement like a feather duster. The light was fading out of the day, fading too fast. He looked to the west and saw that rising dust had blurred the mountains in that direction and might soon erase them completely. The sun was still above the dust, but wouldn't be for long. It was a windstorm and headed their way. 5. The 5 people in the holding cells, the Carvers, Mary Jackson, and old Mr. Whitehair, listened to the man screaming and to the sounds that accompanied the screams, harsh bird cries and flapping wings. At last they stopped. David hoped no one else was dead down there, but when you got right down to it, what were the chances?
What did you say his name was? Mary asked.
Collie Antragian, the old man said.
He sounded as if listening to the screams had pretty much tired him out.
Collie's short for Collier. He come here from one of those mining towns in Wyoming, 15, 16 years ago. Little more than a teenager then he was. Wanted police work. Couldn't get it. Went to work for the Diablo Company up to the pit instead. And that was around the time Diablo was getting ready to pack up and go home. Collie was part of the close-down crew, as I remember.
He told Peter and me the mine was open, Mary said. The old man shook his head in what might have been weariness or exasperation.
There's some thinks old China ain't played out, but they're wrong. It's true they've been bustling around up there again, but they won't take Doonley Squad out of it. Just lose their investors' money and then shut her down. Won't be nobody any happier about it than Jim Reed, either. He's tired of barroom fights. All of us'll be glad when they leave old China alone again. It's haunted. That's what the ignorant folks around these parts think. He paused.
I'm one of them.
Who's Jim Reed? Ralph asked.
Town safety officer. What you'd call chief of police in a bigger burg, but there's only 200 or so people in Desperation these days. Jim had two full-time deputies, Dave Pearson and Collie. Nobody expected Collie to stay around after Diablo folded, but he did. He wasn't married, and he had workman's comp. He floated along for a while, odd-jobbing, and eventually Jim started to throw work his way. He was good enough so that the town officers took Jim's recommendation and hired him on full-time in 91.
Three guys seems like a lot of law for a town this small, Ralph said.
I reckon, but we got some money from Washington, Rural Law Enforcement Act, plus we landed a contract with Sedalia County to keep school on the unincorporated lands round here. Pop the speeders, jug the drunks, all such as that.
More coyote wails from outside. They sounded shimmery in the rising wind.
Mary asked, what did he get workman's comp for? Some kind of mental problem?
No'm. Pickup he was riding in turned turtle on its way down into the pit yonder. The China. Just before the Diablo people gave it up as a bad job, this was. Blew out his knee. Boy was fit enough after, but he had a limp. No question about that.
Then it's not him, Mary said flatly.
The old man looked at her, shaggy eyebrows raised.
The man who killed my husband does not limp.
No, the old man agreed. He spoke with a weird kind of serenity. No, he don't. But it's Collie, all right. I've been seeing him most every day for 15 years. Have bought him drinks and the broken drum and had him buy me a few in return over at Bud's Suds. He was the one who came to the clinic, took pictures and dusted for prints the time those fellows broke in. Probably looking for drugs they were, but I don't know. They never caught him.
Are you a doctor, mister? David asked.
Vet, the old man said. Tom Billingsley's my name.
He held out a big, worn hand that shook a little. David took it gingerly.
Downstairs, a door smashed open.
Here we are, Big John, the cop said.
His voice rolled jovially up the stairs. Your room awaits.
Room? Hell, a regular efficiency apartment. Up you go.
We forgot the word processor, but we left you some great walls and a few little hallmark sentiments like, suck my cock and I fucked your sister to get you started.
Tom Billingsley glanced toward the door which gave upon the stairs, then looked back at David. He spoke loud enough for the others to hear, but it was David he looked at. David he seemed to want to tell.
Tell you something else, he said. He's bigger.
What do you mean?
But David thought he knew.
What I said. Collie was never a midget, stood about 6'4", I'd judge, and probably weighed about 230. But now...
He glanced toward the doorway to the stairs again, toward the sound of approaching, clumping footsteps. Two sets. Then he looked back at David.
Now I'd say he's at least 3 inches more than that, wouldn't you? And maybe 60 pounds heavier.
That's crazy, Ellen cried. Absolutely nuts.
Yes'm, the white-haired vet agreed. But it's true.
The door to the stairs flew all the way open, and a man with a bloody face and shoulder-length gray hair, it was also streaked and clumped with blood, flew into the room. He didn't cross it with Mary Jackson's balletic grace, but stumbled at the halfway point and fell to his knees, holding his hands out in front of him to keep from crashing into the desk. The man who followed him through the door was the man who had brought them all to this place, and yet he wasn't. He was a kind of blood gorgon, a creature who appeared to be disintegrating before their very eyes. He surveyed them from the melting ramparts of his face, and his mouth spread in a wide, lip-splitting grin. "Look at us," he said in a thick, sentimental voice. "Look at us, would you? Gosh, just one big, happy family." Part 2. Desperation. In these silences, something may rise. Chapter 1. 1.
Steve?
What?
Is that what I think it is?
She was pointing out her window, pointing west.
What do you think it is?
Sand, she said. Sand and wind.
Yep, I'd say that's what it is.
Pull over a minute, would you?
He looked at her, questioning.
Just for a minute.
Steve Ames pulled the Ryder van over to the side of the road, which led south from Highway 50 to the town of Desperation. They had found it with no trouble at all. Now he sat behind the wheel and looked at Cynthia Smith, who had tickled him even in his unease by calling him her nice new friend. She wasn't looking at her nice new friend now. She was looking down at the bottom of her funky Peter Tosh shirt and plucking at it nervously.
"I'm a hard-headed babe," she said without looking up. "A little psychic, but hard-headed just the same. Do you believe that?"
"I guess."
"And practical. Do you believe that?"
"Sure."
"That's why I made fun of your intuition or whatever. But you thought we'd find something out there by the road, and we did."
"Yes, we did."
"So it was a good intuition."
"Would you get to the point? My boss..."
"Right. Your boss, your boss, your boss. I know that's what you're thinking about, and practically all you're thinking about. And that's what's got me worried. Because I have a bad feeling about this, Steve. A bad intuition."
He looked at her. Slowly, reluctantly, she raised her head and looked back at him. What he saw in her eyes startled him badly. It was the flat shine of fear.
"What is it? What are you afraid of?"
"I don't know."
"Look, Cynthia, all we're going to do is find a cop, lacking that a phone booth, and report Johnny missing. Also a bunch of people named Carver."
"Just the same."
"Don't worry. I'll be careful. Promise."
"Would you try 911 on your cellular again?"
She asked this in a small, meek voice that was not much like her usual one. He did, to please her, expecting nothing, and nothing was what he got, not even a recording this time. He didn't know for sure, but he thought the oncoming windstorm, or dust storm, or whatever they called them out here, might be screwing things up even worse.
"Sorry, no go," he said. "Want to try it yourself? You might have better luck, the woman's touch and all that."
She shook her head. "Do you feel anything? Anything at all?" He sighed. Yes, he felt something. It reminded him of the way he had sometimes felt in early puberty back in Texas. The summer he had turned 13 had been the longest, sweetest, strangest summer of his life.
Toward the end of August, evening thunderstorms had often moved through the area. Brief but hellacious convulsions, the old cowboys called benders. And in that year, a year when it seemed that every other pop song on the radio was by the Bee Gees, the hushed minutes before these storms, black sky, still air, sharpening thunder, lightning jabbing at the prairie like forks into tough meat, had somehow turned him on in a way he had never experienced since. His eyes felt like globes of electricity in chrome sockets. His stomach rolled, his penis filled with blood and stood up hard as a skillet handle. A feeling of terrified ecstasy came in those hushes, a sense that the world was about to give up some great secret, to play it like a special card. In the end, of course, there had never been a revelation, unless his discovery of how to masturbate a year or so later had been it. Only rain. That was how he felt now, only there was no hard-on, no tingling arm hairs, no ecstasy, and no sense of terror, not really. What he had been feeling ever since she had uncovered the boss's motorcycle helmet was a sense of low foreboding, a sense that things had gone wrong and would soon go wronger. Until she had spoken up just now, he'd pretty much written that feeling off. As a kid, he'd probably just been responding to changes in the air pressure as the storm approached, or electricity in the air, or some other damn thing. And a storm was coming now, wasn't it? Yes. So it was probably the same thing, deja vu all over again, as they said, perfectly understandable. Yet, yeah, okay, I do feel something. But what in the hell can I do about it? You don't want me to turn back, do you? No, we can't do that. Just be careful, okay? A gust of wind shook the rider truck. A cloud of tawny sand blew across the road, turning it into a momentary mirage. Okay, but you've got to help. He got the truck moving again. The setting sun had touched the rising membrane of sand in the west now, and its bottom arc had gone as red as blood. Oh, yeah, she said, grimacing as a fresh blast of wind hit the truck. You can count on that. 2. The blood-soaked cop locked the newcomer into the cell next to David Carver and Tom Billingsley. That done, he turned slowly on his heels in a complete circle, his half-peeled, bleeding face solemn and contemplative. Then he reached into his pocket and brought out the key ring again. He selected the same one as before, David noticed. Square, with a black mag strip on it, so it was probably a master. "Eeny, meeny, miny, moe," he said. "Catch a tourist by the toe." He walked toward the cell which held David's mother and father. As he approached, they drew back, arms around each other again. "You leave them alone!" David cried, alarmed. Billingsley took his arm above the elbow, but David shook it off. "Do you hear me? Leave them alone!" "In your dreams, brat," Conley and Trajan said. He poked the key into the cell's lock, and there was a little thump as the tumblers turned. He pulled the door open. "Good news, Ellie. Your parole came through. Pop on out here." Ellie shook her head. Shadows had begun to gather in the holding area now, and her face swam in them, pale as paper. Ralph put his other arm around her waist and drew her back even farther. "Haven't you done enough to our family?" he asked. "In a word, no." And Trajan drew his cannon-sized gun, pointed it at Ralph, and cocked it. "You come out of here right now, little lady, or I'll shoot this no-chin pecker-checker spang between the eyes. You want his brains in his head or drying on the wall? It's all the same to me, either way." "God, make him quit it," David prayed. "Please make him quit it. If you could bring Brian back from wherever he was, you can do that. You can make him quit it. Dear God, please don't let him take my mother." Ellie was pushing Ralph's hands down, pushing them off her. "Ellie, no!" "I have to. Don't you see that?" Ralph let his hands fall to his sides.
And Trajan dropped the hammer on his gun and slid it back into his holster. He held one hand out to Ellen, as if inviting her to take a spin on the dance floor. And she went to him. When she spoke, her voice was very low. David knew she was saying something she didn't want him to hear, but his ears were very good. "If you want that, take me where my son won't have to see."
"Don't worry," Entragian said in that same low conspirator's voice. "I don't want that. Especially not from you. Now come on."
He slammed the cell door shut, giving it a little shake to make sure it was locked, while he held on to David's mother with the other hand. Then he led her toward the door. "Mom!" David screamed. He seized the bars and shook them. The cell door rattled a little, but that was all. "Mom, no! Leave her alone, you bastard! Leave my mother alone!"
"Don't worry, David. I'll be back," she said, but the soft, almost uninflected quality of her voice scared him badly. It was as if she were already gone, or as if the cop had hypnotized her just by touching her. "Don't worry about me."
"No!" David screamed. "Daddy, make him stop! Make him stop!"
In his heart was a growing certainty. If the huge, bloody cop took his mother out of this room, they would never see her again.
"David."
Ralph took two blundering steps backward, sat on the bunk, put his hands over his face, and began to cry.
"I'll take care of her, Dave. Don't worry," Entragian said. He was standing by the door to the stairs and holding Ellen Carver's arm above the elbow. He wore a grin that would have been resplendent if not for his blood-streaked teeth. "I'm sensitive. A real Bridges of Madison County kind of guy, only without the cameras."
"If you hurt her, you'll be sorry," David said. The cop's smile faded. He looked both angry and a little hurt.
"Perhaps I will, but I doubt it. I really do. You're a little prey boy, aren't you?"
David looked at him steadily, saying nothing.
"Yes. Yes, you are. You've just got that prey boy look about you. Great gosh almighty eyes and a real jeepers creepers mouth. A little prey boy in a baseball shirt. Gosh!"
He put his head close to Ellen's and looked slyly at the boy through the gauze of her hair.
"Do all the praying you want, David, but don't expect it to do you any help. Your God isn't here, any more than he was with Jesus when Jesus hung dying on the cross with flies in his eyes. Tack!"
Ellen saw it coming up the stairs. She screamed and tried to pull back, but Entragian held her where she was. The coyote oiled through the doorway. It didn't even look at the screaming woman with her arm pinched in the cop's fist, but crossed calmly to the center of the room. Then it stopped, turned its head over one shoulder, and fixed its yellow, stuffed animal stare on Entragian.
"Allah," he said, and let go of Ellen's arm long enough to spank his right hand across the back of his left hand in a quick gesture that reminded David of a flat stone skipping across the surface of a pond. "Him en toe."
The coyote sat down.
"This guy is fast," Entragian said. He was apparently speaking to them all, but it was David he was looking at. "I mean, the guy is fast. Faster than most dogs. You stick a hand or foot out of your cell, he'll have it off before you know it's gone. I guarantee that."
"You leave my mother alone," David said.
"Son," Entragian said regretfully, "I'll put a stick up your mother's twat and spin her until she catches fire if I so decide, and you'll not stop me. And I'll be back for you."
He went out the door, pulling David's mother with him. 3. There was silence in the room, broken only by Ralph Carver's choked sobs and the coyote, which sat panting and regarding David with its unpleasantly intelligent eyes. Little drops of spittle fell from the end of its tongue like drops from a leaky pipe. "Take heart, son," the man with the shoulder-length gray hair said. He sounded like a guy more used to taking comfort than giving it. "You saw him. He's got internal bleeding. He's losing his teeth. One eye's ruptured right out of his head. He can't last much longer."
"It won't take him long to kill my mom if he decides to," David said. "He already killed my little sister. He pushed her down the stairs and broke her neck." His eyes abruptly blurred with tears, and he willed them back. This was no time to get bawling. "Yes, but..." The gray-haired man trailed off. David found himself remembering an exchange with the cop when they had been on their way to this town, when they had still thought the cop was sane and normal and only helping them out. He had asked the cop how he knew their name, and the cop had said he'd read it on the plaque over the table. It was a good answer. There was a plaque with their name on it over the table. But Entragian never would have been able to see it from where he was standing at the foot of their RV stairs. "I've got eagle eyes, David," he'd said, "and those are eyes that see the truth from afar." Ralph Carver came slowly forward to the front of his cell again, almost shuffling. His eyes were bloodshot, the lids puffy, his face ravaged. For a moment, David felt almost blinded with rage, shaken by a desire to scream, "This is all your fault. Your fault that Pi's dead. Your fault that he's taken Mom off to kill her or rape her. You and your gambling. You and your stupid vacation ideas. He should have taken you, Dad. He should have taken you." "Stop it, David." His thought, Gene Martin's voice. "That's just the way it wants you to think." "It?" The cop, Entragian. Was that who the voice meant by it? And what way did he, or it, want him to think? For that matter, why would it care what way he thought at all? "Look at that thing," Ralph said, staring at the coyote. "How could he call it in here like that? And why does it stay?" The coyote turned toward Ralph's voice, then glanced at Mary, then looked back at David. It panted. More saliva fell to the hardwood floor, where a little puddle was forming. "He's got them trained somehow," the gray-haired man said. "Like the birds. He's got some trained buzzards out there. I killed one of the scraggy bastards. I stomped it." "No," Mary said.
"No," Billingsley echoed. "I'm sure that coyotes can be trained, but this is not training."
"Of course it is," the gray-haired man snapped.
"That cop," David said, "Mr. Billingsley says he's taller than he used to be. 3 inches at least."
"That's insane." The gray-haired man was wearing a motorcycle jacket. Now he unzipped one of the pockets, took out a battered roll of Lifesavers, and put one in his mouth.
"Sir, what's your name?" Ralph asked the gray-haired man.
"Marinville. Johnny Marinville. I'm a..."
"What you are is blind if you can't see that something very terrible and very out of the ordinary is going on here."
"I didn't say it wasn't terrible, and I certainly didn't say it was ordinary," the gray-haired man replied. He went on, but then the voice came again, the outside voice, and David lost track of their conversation.
"The soap, David. The soap." He looked at it, a green bar of Irish Spring sitting beside the spigot, and thought of Entragian saying, "I'll be back for you." The soap. Suddenly he understood, or thought he did, hoped he did.
"I better be right. I better be right, or..."
He was wearing a Cleveland Indians t-shirt. He pulled it off, dropped it by the cell door. He looked up and saw the coyote staring at him. Its ragged ears were all the way up again, and David thought he could hear it growling, low and far back in its throat. "Son," his father asked, "what do you think you're doing?" Without answering, he sat down on the end of the bunk, took off his sneakers, and tossed them over to where his shirt lay. Now there was no question that the coyote was growling, as if it knew what he was planning to do, as if it meant to stop him if he actually tried it. Don't be a dope. Of course it means to stop you if you try it. Why else did the cop leave it there? You just have to trust. Trust and have faith. Have faith that God will protect me, he murmured. He stood up, unbuckled his belt, then paused with his fingers on the snap of his jeans. Ma'am, he said. Ma'am? She looked at him, and David felt himself blush. I wonder if you'd mind turning around, he said. I have to take off my pants, and I guess I better take off my underwear, too. What in God's name are you thinking about? His father asked. There was panic in his voice now. Whatever it is, I forbid it. Absolutely. David didn't reply, only looked at Mary. Looked at her as steadily as the coyote was looking at him. She returned his look for a moment, then, without saying a word, turned her back. The man in the motorcycle jacket sat on his bunk, crunching his lifesaver and watching him. David was as body shy as most 11-year-olds, and that steady gaze made him uncomfortable. But, as he had already pointed out to himself, this was no time to be a dope. He took another glance at the bar of Irish Spring, then thumbed down his pants and undershorts. 4. Nice, Cynthia said. I mean, that's class. What? Steve asked. He was sitting forward, watching the road carefully. More sand and tumbleweeds were blowing across it now, and the driving had gotten tricky. The sign, see it? He looked. The sign, which had originally read, Desperation's Church and Civic Organizations Welcome You, had been changed by some wit with a spray can. It now read, Desperation's Dead Dogs Welcome You. A rope, frayed at one end, flapped back and forth in the wind. Old Shep himself was gone, however. The buzzards had gotten their licks in first. Then the coyotes had come. Hungry and not a bit shy about eating a first cousin, they had snapped the rope and dragged the shepherd's carcass away, pausing only to squabble and fight with one another. What remained, mostly bones and toenails, lay over the next rise. The blowing sand would cover it soon enough. Boy, folks around here must love a good laugh, Steve said. They must. She pointed. Stop there. It was a rusty Quonset hut. The sign in front of it read Desperation Mining Corp. There was a parking lot beside it with 10 or 12 cars and trucks in it. He pulled over but didn't turn into the lot, at least not yet. The wind was blowing more steadily now, the gusts gradually merging into one steady blast. To the west, the sun was a surreal red-orange disk hanging over the Desitoya Mountains, as flat and bloated as a photo of the planet Jupiter. Steve could hear a fast and steady tink, 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 tink coming from somewhere nearby, possibly the sound of a steel lanyard clip banging against a flagpole. What's on your mind? He asked her. Let's call the cops from here. There's people. See the lights? He glanced toward the Quonset and saw 5 or 6 golden squares of brightness toward the rear of the building. In the dusty gloom, they looked like lighted windows in a train car. He looked back at Cynthia and shrugged. Why from here, when we could just drive to the local cop shop? The middle of town, such as it is, can't be far. She rubbed one hand across her forehead as if she were tired or getting a headache. You said you'd be careful. I said I'd help you be careful. That's what I'm trying to do now. I sort of want to see how things are hanging before someone in a uniform sits me down in a chair and starts shooting questions. And don't ask me why, because I don't really know. If we call the cops and they sound cool, that's fine. They're cool, we're cool. But where the fuck were they? Never mind your boss, he disappeared almost clean. But an RV parked beside the road, the tires flat, door unlocked, valuables inside? I mean, give me a break. Where were the cops? It goes back to that, doesn't it? Yeah, back to that. The cops could have been at the scene of a road accident, or a ranch fire, or a convenience store stick-up, even a murder, and she knew it. All of them, because there just weren't that many cops out in this part of the world. But still, yeah, it came back to that. Because it felt more than funny. It felt wrong.
Okay, Steve said mildly, and turned into the parking lot. Might not be anybody at what passes for the Desperation PD anyhow. It's getting late. I'm surprised there's still anyone here, to tell you the truth. Must be money and minerals, huh?
He parked next to a pickup, opened the door, and the wind snatched it out of his hand. It banged the side of the truck. Steve winced, half expecting a slim Pickens type to come running toward him, holding his hat on with one hand and yelling, "Hey there, boy!" No owner did. A tumbleweed zoomed by, apparently headed for Salt Lake City, but that was all. And the alkali dust was flying, plenty of it. He had a red bandana in his back pocket. He took it out, knotted it around his neck, and pulled it up over his mouth. "Hold it, hold it," he said, tugging her arm to keep her from opening her door just yet. He leaned over so he could open the glove compartment. He rummaged and found another bandana, this one blue, and handed it to her. "Put that on first." She held it up, examined it gravely, then turned her wide little girl eyes on him again. "No cootie bugs?" He snorted and grinned behind the red bandana. "Area one, ma'am, as we say back in Lubbock. Put it on." She knotted it, then pulled it up. "Butch and Sundance," she said, her voice a little muffled. "Yeah, Bonnie and Clyde." "Omar and Sharif," she said, and giggled. "Be careful getting out. The wind's really getting cranked up."